Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show improve. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
Hold up, I Jack Daniels, watch the women say. For the money and the fame and the antics, man, goddamn, yeah, yeah. So pour me some Jack Daniels, yeah, yeah. Jack Daniels, last man standing. For the money and the fame and the antics, for the pain they don't really see the damage, yeah. Just me and my boy Jack Daniels.
And finally today, here is one more story about what's behind a name. We're talking about Jack Daniel. Jack Daniel is a household name in the United States. For some people, Jack Daniels is almost a synonym for Tennessee whiskey. But the name Nearest Green, not so much. But as it turns out, Jack Daniel likely learned the art of distillery from Nathan Nearest Green sometime in the 1850s in rural Tennessee. Green was born into slavery. He was hired to teach Daniel, and upon emancipation, he went to work for Jack Daniel's company along with two of his sons. But for most of the company's history, Green's contribution was not mentioned until last year when the company announced it would incorporate Nearest Green into their official narrative. The story was picked up by the New York Times, and that's where Fawn Weaver comes in. She is an author and a real estate investor, and she actually moved to Lynchburg, Tennessee, where the company is based, and she spent much of the past year interviewing Green's descendants, combing through archives, and filling in the missing pieces in the Nearest Green story. We wanted to hear more about that, so I'm joined now by Fawn Weaver from Nashville Public Radio in Nashville, Tennessee. Fawn Weaver, welcome. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
What was it that sparked your interest in knowing more about Mr. Green? I mean, actually, to be honest, it sounds a little bit like you were annoyed that he wasn't getting his due.
I won't say that I was annoyed because I didn't know at the time he wasn't getting his due. So I was in Singapore with my husband, and it was on the front page of the New York Times International Edition there. And first of all, if you are in Singapore and you're reading a story about a slave who may have taught the person who began the largest American whiskey brand in history, you want to know a little bit more. And if you're an author and someone like me, where not only do I like to write a great story, but I also like it to really permeate the community and those around me, but also to spread around the world. So this was one of those rare stories that I thought, gosh, if there's something more to this than what is being said in the New York Times, this could be an incredible story. But what I thought it was and what it was are two different things.
So after reading about Nathan Nearest Green, you decided to actually move to Lynchburg to uncover more about his story. Now, that seems like a pretty drastic step to satisfy your curiosity. I don't know.
Well, I tell you what, it did not go quite in that order. So I planned on going to Lynchburg for 4 days. And my husband, trying to convince him to go to a city in the South called Lynchburg, and we're both black, it was not easy. But when I got there and I began speaking to people, I realized that the story of Nearest Green, although no one had been talking about it for at least the last 40, 50 years, I realized once I got there, the only way people were going to share the story with me is if they felt safe. And the only way people in a small town feel safe with an outsider is that outsider becomes an insider. And that's why I moved to Lynchburg.
One of the things that the Times story pointed out is that this story had been kind of an open secret among descendants and among people in that area. But it wasn't something that was promoted as part of the company's history. Why do you think that is?
You know, I don't know. What I will say is when I arrived there, I thought that there would be few people who knew who Nearest was. And I happened to be getting a pedicure, of all things. And the woman in the nail salon, it took me a full half hour to really build up to ask this question. Because if you think about it, I'm an African-American going into an almost all-white town to investigate a story on a slave who's been left out of the history of their town hero. So I wasn't quite sure what to expect. And the nail salon, the woman, I finally look at her and I said, so when you heard the story or you read it in the New York Times about the slave who taught Jack Daniel, I mean, what was your thought? What was the thought of everyone or the mood in this town? And she looks at me with the most blank face. And I said, how did people react? And she says, well, we didn't. We've always known. So it wasn't a secret in Lynchburg. It just somehow never left Lynchburg.
So, you know, this comes at a time when there's, as we said, a lot of focus on Confederate monuments and why they are where they are and what they are for. Does this story in some way fit into that story? Is it part of that? And why do you think this is so important that this be known?
I think the reason why this fits in is for a reason completely different than what most people may think. The relationship between Jack Daniel and Nearest Green was a great one. Nearest Green was not Jack's slave. Jack did not have any slaves. Nearest Green was Jack's mentor. And Jack's descendants and Nearest's descendants, not only were they friends, they lived side by side. They worked side by side. There was not a distinguishment between the two, even though you're talking about the late 1800s, early 1900s. So if you can picture that in your mind, you have blacks and whites living side by side in equality. So I think when we look at what's going on with the Confederate monuments, when you look at Charlottesville, putting that in context with what I have been uncovering over the last 10 months is pretty phenomenal, because if we can somehow figure out how to do in the rest of America what Jack and Nearest and their descendants learned how to do in Lynchburg, we've got hope.
Now, you've actually started bottling and selling a whiskey called Uncle Nearest 1856. Tell me about that.
Yes. 100 proof, born and raised in Tennessee. So when I met here in Nashville with Nearest's descendants, I said, what is the one thing that you believe that should be done to honor Nearest Green? And they essentially said, we believe that his name should live on his own bottle. And there was someone who we knew very well from Lynchburg, ironically, a descendant, not of Nearest, but of Jack, and who had been in the Tennessee whiskey business for about 31 years before she retired. And when we first began researching, she says, I've always known about Nearest, and I would love to be able to help with any project you might do. And so after I met with the descendants, I called her and I said, I have no idea how we could do this, but this is what they want. And if you can help us to do this, I will figure out how to raise all the money that will be needed to make it happen. And essentially, we reached out to every investor, every friend that we knew, told them the story, said this is what we believe should happen to truly honor him around the world. And you had so many people step up to the plate and say, we're in. It debuted in Nashville 3 weeks ago. I think we're already in 150 stores and they keep selling out. So it is very clear that people care about honoring Nearest Green, and I could not be more thrilled.
Fawn Weaver is an author and entrepreneur. She's been researching the history of Nearest Green, who taught distilling to Jack Daniel. And she joined us from WPLN in Nashville, Tennessee. Fawn Weaver, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Seattle's a great place to visit because it has, I guess you could say, a little bit of everything, but I like to think of it as a lot of everything.
We turn now to local sports here on KNKX. The Seahawks opened their regular season on the road Sunday afternoon. They play the Packers in Green Bay. The game follows a week of drama involving defensive end Michael Bennett. It's the topic of this week's conversation between KNKX sports commentator Art Thiel and 88.5's Kirsten Kendrick.
Michael Bennett was questioned in handcuffs by police in Las Vegas last month in a case he claims was racial profiling. He says police used excessive force. Art, it appears he's been deeply affected by this experience.
Yeah, Michael Bennett this week was pretty shaken. He met with the media and told the story of being in Las Vegas as a spectator at the Conor McGregor-Floyd Mayweather fight August 26th, and 3 hours after that, he was in a casino where shots were fired, supposedly. At least that was the rumor that started the crowd moving, and police responded. And there was no evidence of a shooter, no evidence of a shooting. So Bennett somehow found himself on a sidewalk, cuffed, and being, in his words, assaulted by a Las Vegas police officer. Las Vegas police responded with a press conference on Wednesday that talked about, no, there was no racial profiling, but in a five-minute video, a police cam, it was a very odd thing that produced only a quick shot of a police officer on the sidewalk holding a gun over Michael Bennett's head. And Bennett said the officer threatened to blow his head off. This made national news, and it could not have been more ironic because Bennett has been sitting for national anthems, his way of protesting the social injustice he sees. He specifically addressed the shooting of unarmed African Americans by police when he said it could have been him.
I'm just lucky to be here to be able to speak about it. Any moment I could have made the wrong decision and whether move, it felt like I was resisting or doing something wrong, and the Seahawks would be wearing the patch with number 72 on it.
That's a really profound statement by him. And the irony, of course, is he's been such an activist and such a courageous figure in trying to call attention to these episodes.
So all of this is swirling around the Seahawks' start of the regular season on Sunday in Green Bay.
Billie Holiday, I sing your blues. Bet your life against me and I swear to God you'll lose it. Motherfuck the cops, we still singing for St. Louis. Motherfuck the cops, we still singing for St. Louis. Motherfuck the cops, we still singing for St. Louis.
If there's one topic in Missouri politics that's evoked lots and lots of opinions lately, it's whether State Senator Maria Chappelle Nadal should stay or go.
No debate. I condemn it. It's outrageous, and she should resign.
It was something silly to say. She immediately deleted it. It's not a big deal. This is a lot of fake outrage.
She has no choice but to resign. I mean, I don't know how she stays in office.
I hate to think that it's because she's a black woman, but I don't know why they want to throw her under the bus.
The University City Democrat placed her political career into doubt after she posted, then deleted, a Facebook comment hoping for President Donald Trump's assassination. Chappelle Nadal publicly apologized to Trump, her Senate colleagues, and the state. But some, including Republican Lieutenant Governor Mike Parson, want senators to expel Chappelle Nadal from the Senate during next week's veto session.
I believe that Senator Chappelle Nadal's remarks and her unwillingness to make take responsibility for what she said make it clear that she is no longer fit to serve our state.
But State Representative Warren Love greatly complicated the push to get rid of Chappelle Nadal. Last week, the Osceola Republican posted on Facebook that people who vandalized a Confederate monument in Springfield should be hung from a tall tree with a long rope. Both parties condemned Love's comments, but some Democrats, such as State Representative Michael Butler of St. Louis, are demanding that the two lawmakers receive equal punishment.
And they have set a standard and set a precedent of how they react to these types of posts, and they could just copy and paste the same statement they made about Maria Chappelle Nadal and send it about Warren Love. It isn't hard.
On this episode of the Politically Speaking podcast, I talk with Chappelle Nadal about whether her colleagues will back off on their threat to expel her. And Joe Manis and I will talk with two Republican political operatives with differing perspectives on whether she should be expelled.
And I made a mistake. And I'm owning up to it. And I am not ever going to make a mistake like that again. And I have learned my lesson. My judge and my jury is my Lord Jesus Christ.
That's State Senator Maria Chappelle Nadal last month at a press conference in Ferguson. And I'm Jason Rosenbaum, a reporter with St. Louis Public Radio and the co-host of the Politically Speaking podcast. I had a chance to talk with Chappelle Nadal on September 6th, which is exactly 1 week before lawmakers will return to Jefferson City for their annual veto session. As of right now, it's unclear whether lawmakers will actually consider kicking Chappelle Nadal out of the Senate. But one of the first questions I asked her during our interview was whether she had a particular message to the senators that will ultimately decide her fate in the General Assembly's upper chamber.
Well, I sent a letter to my colleagues
in the last couple of weeks. And one of the things that I stated to them is that, you know, sometimes when we have a lot of issues in our district, you respond in a certain way. And I made it very clear to them and to others that with everything going on, I had a lot of frustration and a lot of anger in my heart. And I also asked them for forgiveness and told them that when you are dealing with some of these issues, you know, 3 weeks ago, it was the trauma that is happening in the community in which I serve in one way or the other. So we had the anniversary of Ferguson and the shooting of Michael Brown. A lot of the people who already have PTSD and other anxiety realized a heightened anxiety after they saw the visuals in Charlottesville. And I have this practice where I go through all of my followers and people who I follow. I go through their postings on social media to see how they're doing. I've been doing that for the last 3 years just to console individuals and give them some hope from time to time. I do that. That is part of my leadership. And I noticed that everything was okay, in a sense. There's some anxiety during the anniversary, and then things just started changing when Charlottesville happened. And those images on TV were very, very, very disturbing to the people I represent and the people who I follow on social media. And then things really, really started triggering individuals here in St. Louis when the president made his statement. And basically what his statement meant to me is that, you know, he made room for people who practice covert racism, because they could say, hey, at least I'm not Donald Trump. But there is a wide variety of things that could happen between what we deal with as minorities and women in the state of Missouri and in St. Louis in particular, and what the president was stating, or at least inferring at that time. And that's pretty much what led me to this comment that I made on my personal Facebook. And I saw the changes in people's attitude on social media. I saw the trauma. There were people who could not sleep, including myself, because they were repeating in their minds the experience of Ferguson, which was not nice. So, you know, if you asked me, Maria, you know, what were you thinking when you wrote that down? I was thinking about the trauma that St. Louisans are incurring. Even now, as we're dealing with this Jason Stockley verdict, a lot of what you're seeing and hearing is a result of the trauma that people incurred in the last 3 years and over their lifetimes through their experiences.
This is from the Kansas City Star. In a letter to his Republican Senate colleagues this week, GOP Senator Bob Dixon of Springfield called Chappelle Nadal's Facebook post intemperate and embarrassing. He even noted that in the past she has been, quote, guilty of disrespect to the Senate and sometimes to its members personally by contemptuous behavior and comments. But while he will support an official censure of Chappelle Nadal as well as her permanent removal from Senate committees, Dixon said he would not vote to expel her from the Senate. And those words were compelling to me because Senator Dixon is not one of your political adversaries. He's not Lacey Clay. He's not Josh Peters. He's not Jay Nixon. He's somebody who came to Ferguson from Springfield after Ferguson happened. And I talked with him about that. And by mentioning the fact that the disrespect to the Senate and sometimes its members, it prompted me this question. If one of your political adversaries had done exactly the same thing that you did, would you show them the same mercy that you're asking from your colleagues?
Absolutely. So I can give you an example.
Yes.
Mr. Clay said something to the effect he was going to give Donald Trump the benefit of the doubt. And I was appalled by that as a Democrat. And I didn't publicly really respond to that. I just knew that that was hurtful to the people that are in the 1st Congressional District because we've seen who this person is. Now, I say that with the caveat that I've sent a letter to the president's office at the White House asking him for forgiveness as well, and also working with him in the future. Because one thing that you should know as well as others is that Senator Dixon and I actually work together. And I have a history of working with my Republican colleagues on anything from I think it was Will Krause, where we dealt with Medicaid fraud, people who were using these resources to go to a strip club or get liquor instead of using it to help their families eat. And another example is there are other things, education reform. And it's unacceptable that many of our children are in school buildings that are totally unaccredited. So I've worked with my Republican colleagues. We're not going to agree on 100% of everything, but where we can build bridges, we do.
What do you think the consequences should be for what you posted on Facebook?
You know, I'm really reflecting on Article 2 and how the First Amendment of the Constitution weighs out. You know, if I was expelled, then there would be an immediate challenge to what kind of rights an individual has. There are several cases that one can go through, including Julian Bond from the 1960s, who made a statement that was far worse than mine. And the Georgia legislature at that time did everything they could possible not to seat Julian Bond. And it went all the way to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court said this is language that is protected by the First Amendment. So while we do have an Article 2 in our state's constitution, it would be in conflict with the First Amendment, and that question would be the only question in the country to determine whether or not an elected official has the ability to be dismissed based on a First Amendment right that's given to every other citizen.
Would you be okay with a censure and being removed from your committees permanently as a punishment?
Well, here's what I would say. Being on a committee allows for residents to come to their state capitol and say, I like a bill or I hate a bill, and this is why. And what many people don't understand is I can still sit on that dais in those committees and listen to those folks, just not vote. And second to that, that's not where the sausage is made. Third to that, I still have email. I still have in-district meetings, and people let me know if they're for or against legislation, regardless of if I'm sitting on a committee. But I have staff members who go to committee with me, and especially for an issue like education. There's nothing that prohibits me from going into that committee room and listening to the testimony. And that's part of the job. A lot of what we do has to do with sometimes as easy as sometimes it's not easy, but dealing with getting 100-year-old trees that have fallen on someone's house, or getting child support, or helping to get disability. That is really where it's at. And I've always prided myself in constituency services. I guarantee you there is no other legislator that has held 70 town hall meetings on one subject matter or any subject matter in 19 months. I guarantee that.
How do you think the controversy over Representative Warren Love affects your fate?
Well, I think that your listeners should judge for themselves. If you look at the response that the lieutenant governor gave to my statement when I made it versus the response to Representative Love's statement, there's a difference. Obviously, I mean, the lieutenant governor went above and beyond, you know, and making sure that there was some mechanism for me to be ousted. When Representative Love made statements that he did not want to or should not have stated, you know, the response was by far different. I know that for the speaker, Todd Richardson, he was very supportive of me resigning or being ousted by the Senate. And when Representative Love made his misstatement, was saying that it's an unfortunate mistake. So there are differences in how I was treated. I don't know if it's because I'm in the minority party. I don't know if it's because I'm a woman. I don't know if it's because I'm a minority resident. But all of these things have to come into play. Many of my supporters have stated things that the president has said, things that are far worse. I have to be accountable for what I have stated. I am interested in getting back to my work, my research to help save lives. That's what I'm doing. That's what I've done. And many of my political opponents who have been very aggressive in seeing that I'm either censored or, you know, supporting me resigning or supporting me being expelled from the Senate, you know, I would ask them, what work are you doing to save lives in this community? It's been an issue that's been ignored for 70 years, and it should not be the case where people have to protest in someone's office in order to file legislation. And I want to make it very, very clear to NPR listeners, is that this is not done. And it may be your coworker, it may be your daughter or your son or your grandfather that's impacted by issues such as radioactive waste. It may be they work in Bridgeton. Ever since this incident happened, I've learned a lot. At first, I was a little bit, because I was getting death threats like I did in Ferguson. But when I went out into the public, there is an overwhelming support by people. And there, I will never forget this one woman. We were at the gas station and she stopped. She's like, I know you. I know you. I know you. I don't like what you said, but I know why you said it. You know, it took me an hour to get through the grocery store the other day, and I only purchased like $17 worth of stuff, and I was held on the parking lot for like 20 minutes of people having overwhelming support for me, and in the grocery store. So, and the same thing happens for Warren Love too. We've talked a few times.
Talked with Warren Love.
Yes, I've talked to Warren Love a few times over the weekend, and I really wanted to reach out to him because I wanted him to know that I knew what it was like to be attacked, you know, for a mistake that we have made, and I knew that he was in, you know, a precarious situation as I was. And so even though I don't agree with what he said and he doesn't agree with what I said, he represents the far right, and I represent the far left. So even while what I said was wrong, it proves that I'm a Democrat, and I'm a progressive Democrat that believes in having every single human being valued and not disregarded. And if you go back to the statements that we've had to endure for the last 7 or now 8 months, 9 months, you know, I'm seeing a lot of those folks who I've been worried about, who have trauma, I'm seeing that get worse. And I hope that your listeners, no matter what, realize there's a such thing as trauma. And you can't control trauma. Trauma alters your life in a very, very, very real way. And when you can take what I said and use it against me all you want, but the fact remains is the people who are going to be out and looking at what happens with this Jason Stockley case, a lot of them have trauma. And that's why I have filed legislation dealing with trauma. And I hope they take it seriously and advocate for it, having some resolve when you go through situations like Charlottesville or Ferguson.
You know, First Ladies usually have a cause, and you've already said you're interested in speaking out against bullying on social media.
I think it's very important because a lot of children and teenagers are getting hurt, and we need to teach them how to talk to each other, how to treat each other, and to be able to connect with each other on the right way.
It's an ironic choice, since her own husband sent out a stream of pretty nasty tweets during the campaign.
Racially charged comments on social media have an exclusive private school reeling today. Good evening, everyone. I'm Claire Kellett.
And I'm Courtney Bryant. The blurred lines you see here written by students at MICDS are too explosive to show you.
Tonight, News 4 is asking the school what they are doing about it. Matt Sesney has the story.
Horrified, deeply saddened, embarrassed, and outraged.
That's how the head of MICDS reacted to the racist Snapchats from some students. Then there's the local NAACP.
We are gravely concerned that these sorts of remarks are being made.
The Snapchats, now widely circulated, make at least seven mentions of the N-word,
nigger!
Along with a reference to applications to the KKK.
I think that MICDS has a cultural problem that needs to be addressed.
17-year-old Bobby Loomis is a senior at MICDS.
Just in the past year, you've had students on social media posting pictures of themselves in KKK robes. You've seen students making Instagram accounts targeting homosexual students.
It's led some to wonder what's going on at the private school of some 1,200 students.
They've got a real problem over there on Warson Road. And, you know, I'm most particularly concerned regarding how the administration is going to move to action with this.
School leaders tell me their policy on inclusion and respect is clear.
I sure wish it hadn't happened, but the reaction from our internal and our external community has been so clear that I believe we are all on the same page about what we expect of ourselves. So my guess is we will come out of this much stronger.
There have been meetings going on all day here at MICDS with students, parents, and the NAACP. The head of the school tells me there will be a discipline process involved for the students involved, and the punishment could go as high as expulsion. Live in Ladue, Matt Sesney, News 4.
All around the world.
World nigga law.
Four serving members of the British Army have been arrested on suspicion of belonging to a banned far-right group and planning terrorist offences. Our Home Affairs correspondent Dominic Casciani has been following the story.
These four arrests, which happened across England and Wales, one man in his 20s arrested in Birmingham, another in Northampton, another in Ipswich, and a fourth man in his 30s in Powys. They were arrested after a joint operation involving the West Midlands Counter-Terrorism Unit and detectives in the terrorism units in Wales and the East Midlands. So this has been a major operation. And we now have confirmation that all four of them are serving members of the Army. Now, we don't know which regiment, whether it's all the same regiment or different regiments. We simply don't have that information, but clearly they are all serving members. And that the Army were aware of this operation, so they've been supporting the police prior to the arrest. Now, this has been an intelligence-led operation, so it's worth saying that if anyone's been seeing police activity where these searches have been going on, there have been searches as well, that the police are saying there is no specific threat to the public in relation to these arrests of these alleged National Action members. This is a really strange group. They were the first British neo-Nazi group to be banned under terrorism laws. And effectively, to be banned under a terrorism law, there has to be some kind of evidence or intelligence that they're involved in inciting violence or in trying to carry out violent acts for an ideological motive. They were banned last December. They've been carrying out a number of very, very belligerent protests, almost like a flash mob, if you know what I mean, where they just turn up in a city centre masked and carrying Nazi regalia and effectively do the Sieg Heil salute with megaphones, intimidating people and trying to get youth to join and then carry out provocative street demonstrations. And that's why, you know, this group was banned.
Dominic Casciani, our Home Affairs correspondent.
Medical apartheid. The dark history of medical experimentation on black Americans from colonial times to the present.
We've seen the anger in Charlottesville, Durham, and other places, and now in New York City, a statue linked to slavery is causing outrage. The monument stands in East Harlem at one of the entrances to Central Park. Activists and community leaders want it removed. The World's Jasmine Garz with our Cross Women's Lives Project has our story and a warning here. It includes descriptions that some listeners might find disturbing.
Every day, Sashat Mack wakes up and takes this bus to school. She grew up here in Harlem, and every morning the bus drops her off in front of a statue of a man looking down kind of heroically and kind of benevolently at passersby.
Yeah, this has been on my nerves for years.
Sashat can't stand this statue. She's a PhD student in science. She asked me not to say at what school. The statue is of Dr. J. Marion Sims, born in South Carolina. He's considered the father of modern gynecology. He started in the mid-19th century, when childbirth was incredibly risky.
So it was pretty dangerous. There also were no antibiotics, the kinds of things we use now to protect women.
Susan Raverby, a historian of medicine at Wellesley College, reminds me that especially in younger women and women who had a lot of children, childbirth often caused an excruciating condition known as fistula, where the vaginal walls tear.
It often leads to, first of all, incredible infections, and second of all, social isolation. They're going to smell, they're going to be uncomfortable, no one's going to want to be around them. It changes their entire life.
Reverby says, although any woman could get fistula, slaves were particularly vulnerable.
Because of obviously enforced rape as part of the slave process, very, very young women were often giving birth and weren't given proper care.
Dr. Sims was looking for a way to surgically fix fistula. He convinced slave owners to let him experiment on their slaves with the condition. And donating slaves to medicine was not an unusual thing to do back then.
In 1817, a British medical journal published an article claiming that blacks were so insensitive to pain that you could operate on them with as much impunity as you'd operate on a dog or a cat or a rabbit.
Professor Martin Pernick is a medical historian at the University of Michigan. He's written a lot about the history of racism in anesthesiology.
19th century doctors would have said it's much better to have black women because they're less sensitive.
We know some of the names of those women Sims experimented on. Lucy, who was around 18, Anarka, who was about 14, and Betsy.
Sims is frequently portrayed as this Joseph Mengele Nazi doctor type doing horrible experiments on slaves who can't consent.
Dr. Leonard Wall is a professor of anthropology at Washington University in St. Louis. He's worked with fistula survivors around the world, and he says he knows this for sure. Lucy, Anarka, and Betsy would have been in excruciating pain and desperate for relief when they arrived at Sims' house.
And so I think that these were women who had terrible injuries, that they had a deep vested personal interest in having those injuries fixed. That's not the history that's being depicted in the demonstrations against the statues.
Wall is one of J. Marion Sims' more vocal defenders. He says he's seen firsthand how Sims' discoveries helped millions of women in the developing world, even today. Wall also says there are some key pieces of the Sims story people leave out. It's true, he didn't use anesthesia on the slaves he experimented on, but anesthesia would not be widely used or available until a few years later. And in his writings, Sims says he asked the women he experimented on for their consent. But that, the idea that a slave can consent, that is something that baffles activists like Sashat Mack.
If not for the institution of slavery, J. Marion Sims would have been forced to postpone these experiments until the science had caught up, like the science of anesthesia had caught up to his aspirations of curing this surgery. And the fact that there was a population of people who literally had no choice but to consent or but to assent to these surgeries meant that that wasn't something that he had to concern himself with.
Mack is among those who have protested at the site of the statue. They want it removed. The New York City government has responded that it's doing a review of several statues, including this one. Mack says it's frustrating. Every day, it stands here, greeting her on her way to school. The statue of a man who experimented on women who looked like her.
White supremacy doesn't always look like white hoods or Confederate flags or burning crosses. Sometimes it looks like a doctor in a white coat.
Dr. J. Marion Sims finally solved the mystery of how to fix fistula. Silver. After 30 failed gynecological surgical experiments on the slave named Anarka, experiments performed without anesthesia, he discovered silver wire sutures work. He He was hailed as a genius of modern medicine. He moved to New York City. He opened America's first hospital for women, presided over the American Medical Association. He took on patients far more illustrious than Anarka, Betsy, and Lucy. In the 1860s, he became the personal gynecologist of Empress Eugenie de Montijo, Napoleon III's wife. He operated on her. By then, he had started using anesthesia. For the World, Jasmine Garst, Harlem, New York.
Tell us how
we
that was.
4 feet of water to go get them food on the first day. Yeah, that's a lot of shit. But y'all sit here, y'all trying to interview people during their worst times. Like, that's not the smartest thing to do. Like, people are really breaking down, and y'all sitting here with cameras and microphones trying to ask us what the fuck is wrong with us.
I'm so sorry.
And you're really trying to understand it with the microphone still in my face.
Sorry.
With me shivering cold, with my kids wet, and you still putting a microphone
sorry,
in
man.
My face.
Sorry.
Rosa Flores.
The stars at night are big and bright.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We're in the home of Professor Robert Bullard, who teaches at Texas Southern University. He used to be the dean at the Barbara Jordan Mickey Leland School of Public Affairs at TSU. Yes, considered the father of environmental justice, deals with the issue of environmental racism, and that's what we're going to be talking about today in the aftermath of this hurricane-turned-storm Harvey. Who it's affected the most? Whose communities will be rebuilt? It's great to be with you, to get to meet you personally in your home, Professor Bullard. Can you describe what happened to you here at home? You thought you were going to be flooded.
Well, you know, I had been monitoring the storm. I had been watching TV and getting very little sleep. And then we were informed that we had a mandatory evacuation. And I heeded that call, and I tried to move as much of my belongings from downstairs upstairs. And actually, I used muscles that I hadn't used before in that process. And so I evacuated on Tuesday and was able to call a friend and was able to take my, you know, little bag over and stay until this morning. I came back this morning.
So, in fact, your home didn't flood.
No, we didn't flood. The water came up to on the streets, around surrounding streets, and some water came on the street, came up to the curb, but it did not flood. And it was, you know, kind of a challenge getting out of the subdivision to get over to my friend's house, but I was able to maneuver and avoid the water and drive my car, you know, in a way that I was not driving into water. But it was a challenge, but nothing like what other people have experienced.
You have written so much about and been so deeply involved in issues of environmental racism, environmental justice. Do you see the issue of environmental racism, and I'm going to ask you to define it first, playing out here in Houston around the storm?
Well, I think when we look at the color of vulnerability and we look at which communities are actually at greatest risk from disasters and floods like this. Historically, it's been low-income communities and communities of color, communities that live in low-lying areas that are very prone to flooding, and it's very difficult to get insurance, not just flood insurance, but regular insurance because of redlining. So what Harvey has done is to expose those inequalities that existed before the storm. And, you know, as disasters like this widen and exacerbate inequality. And so the communities that are most at risk from not having, you know, the kinds of infrastructure in those areas in terms of flood protection, in terms of trying to get out, in terms of transportation, et cetera. I mean, it played out, up close and personal. And I think as we start to see some of the demographics in terms of communities that will take longer to return, will take longer to get their houses back in order, longer to get their communities and infrastructure back in order. This is not rocket science. And those communities that and individuals, households that don't have that cushion to ward off that kind of disruption, it's always much more difficult for them to return. And I don't see this any different in Houston. And what we have to do is guard against building and rebuilding on that inequity.
We just did a toxic tour of Houston. We were over in Baytown next to the ExxonMobil refinery. I think it's something like the second largest refinery in the country. Right by it, people flooded out. And you've got two many different aspects of this crisis. But one is the contract workers who work at ExxonMobil. They just lose their jobs when the refinery shuts down. And they also get flooded. And the question is, who will get help and who won't? But that issue, for example, while the Republican Texas congressional delegation largely voted against vast help for the Northeast during Superstorm Sandy, clearly Texas will get billions of dollars for FEMA and to rebuild overall. How is it determined who gets support and who doesn't?
Well, you know, the way it works is those individuals in those communities, those families and households that have the resources and the wherewithal to maneuver through this maze of bureaucracies of filing information online and getting access to the different organizations that can assist and support getting, you know, the FEMA grants and the SBA loans and all those things. It's not rocket science, but it's not easy to do that. And if you have individuals who are used to getting online and getting access to information and processing that, they have a head start. You know, there are lots of households right now that are actually hiring contractors that have already gutted their houses and that have already, you know, signed individuals on to fix up and remodel and bring their houses and back to life. And it's not any mystery as to which communities that will somehow be the last to do that. And these are the same communities that didn't have access to loans in terms of neighborhoods loans because of redlining. And what we have to guard against is this rebuilding redlining that somehow allows more affluent communities to access the system, get their communities back in order, and those who are left behind somehow those areas will be the last to come back. So it has to be an equitable recovery, equitable development, and to make sure that those families that somehow may, you know, who's to say that one community should be built or rebuilt, not be rebuilt? And those are policy decisions. And if money is not invested in those areas, and if infrastructure is not invested in those areas, and many of the areas in many of the communities in Houston do not have the infrastructure to protect them from man-made disasters in terms of the flooding, the lack of infrastructure in terms of the protection. You know, a lot of our neighborhoods just have open drainage ditches, gullies, and just very minimum kinds of protection. And so it floods, you know, routinely. And so we're talking about this, you know, biblical flood. And so you can see how not only will they get washed out in terms of their homes, they'll get washed out in terms of their income.
This is the 30th anniversary of the publication of your book, Invisible Houston, The Black Experience in Boom and Bust. Talk about Invisible Houston.
In Invisible Houston that I wrote 30 years ago, there's a huge population that is still invisible. Houston's demographics, you know, a lot of people like to say we are one of the most diverse ethnically and racially cities in the country. We're the fourth largest city in the country. We are racially and ethnically diverse, but when it comes to economics and when it comes to power and decision making, it stops. And so when we talk about this whole question of how invisible, how can we make invisible communities visible? Those communities that have been inundated before the storm by pollution, environmental degradation, living on the fence line with very dangerous kinds of facilities. And when a storm like this happens, it exposes those vulnerabilities. And you have all of this pollution, you know, all of this, you know, oil and chemical plants. And that kind of pollution that's now exposed in the water, and when the flood water recedes, it's going to leave residue. It's going to leave all kinds of stuff that on the school grounds, on the playgrounds, and on people's yards. And so how we're going to deal with those sediments that's left, and we need testing done. We have to make sure it is safe. All the mold, we learned from Katrina that people want to get back in their homes, and that in some cases they're rushing to get back without the proper protection. And with the mold in those homes and people getting sick, we have to make sure that we provide equal protection and equal access to resources to make sure that we do it right. We have to make sure that we protect the most vulnerable population, and we rebuild with the idea that we're rebuilding with resilience. We cannot just, you know, make Houston like it was. Like it was unequal, very unequal, and those populations that lived, for example, on those fence lines with those chemical companies, people say, well, what's happening at the chemical company that burned and exploded? They say it's safe. The chemical company says it's safe. The EPA says it's safe. But I'd like to know, where does the CEO of that company live? If it's so safe, you know what I'm saying? How about him pack up and camp out next door? The problem is individuals making decisions oftentimes don't have to deal with the kinds of issues that fence lines communities have to deal with. Even when we're not talking about flooding, we're talking about the flooding of pollution and chemicals on communities, and people don't ask for to be polluted. It's without their consent.
100% of all city-owned landfills are in black communities, even though the African-American community makes something up like, 25% of the population here?
Black and brown populations have borne the burden, even when the population was majority white. So we have to really talk about environmental justice. We have to talk about environmental racism and call it out when it exists. We can't just run from it and act as if somehow, kumbaya, we all going to get along. Yeah, this storm has brought out the best of Houstonians, but we just can't cover that up. And this history, this legacy of unequal protection, of unequal access to resources. We're an area that we're a city that's over 600 square miles, and we have lots of zip codes, but all zip codes are not created equal. And the idea that somehow we can not address the economic inequality and the racial inequality as we recover, those things need to be made plain and upfront and just acknowledged. Nobody's talking about let's stop anything. Let's acknowledge that we have to be very careful that somehow we don't further disadvantage communities that have been marginalized because of structural discrimination.
At the height of Harvey's fury in Houston, thousands of people sought refuge in the city's convention center. While the numbers have gone down for those who are still there, the sense of desperation is still high. Special correspondent Marcia Biggs has our report.
It's been one of the symbols of the Hurricane Harvey disaster, and the George R. Brown Convention Center is still bustling today. At its highest point since Harvey made landfall 10 days ago, the center was catering to 10,000 people. Today, only around 1,400 remain as full residents. But those who remain are seemingly some of the most vulnerable.
I don't have no friends and no family. I mean, and if they do, they flooded out just as well as I am.
Cheryl Conley has been here since last Tuesday. She has congestive heart failure and epilepsy and hasn't been able to reach her landlord, even though she's heard that her apartment is flooded and mold infested.
How desperate are you to get out of here?
On a scale from one to a million. I'm trying to see why FEMA keep having my status pending, when I have a letter right here from the doctor saying that I'm critical care, that I have congestive heart failure and seizures, and nobody's doing nothing about it.
For now, she says she has nowhere to go. People like Cheryl are turning to the legion of lawyers set up in the lobby.
mostly about visas expiring.
Rita Lucido is a private lawyer and activist coordinating the effort. She says the biggest issues today surround filing for benefits and knowing about renters' rights.
Talk to your landlord about getting your belongings out if anything's left. Ask them if it's safe to go in. And you can negotiate with your landlord to transfer your security deposit to another apartment. Those are the kind of really very practical legal answers for folks who are in a precarious situation.
But renters' rights are way beyond the problems some here are facing. Donna Morrissey is the Red Cross spokesperson.
We have a wide array of people who have special needs. We have people who are in wheelchairs, people who have very serious medical conditions, people who are homeless. The point to remember is that there are a lot of significant problems that any city has prior to the storm making landfall, and they're going to be here after the storm clears and we're trying to help rebuild.
Shina Galvin, homeless for 2 years, had been living under a bridge. Her local food pantry shut down during the storm, and she came to the convention center.
I was very grateful to have this place to come.
How long will you stay?
Until I can get out on my feet or until they shut this down. And then after that, I don't know where I'll go.
So in a way, the storm gave you a place to go.
It did. It did give me a place to go to.
John, as you can see here behind me, people have been coming and going all day long. When I asked the Red Cross how long this shelter is going to be open, I was told there is no set date for closure.
So no end in sight, Marcia. It's now been 10 days since Harvey made landfall. What sorts of people are there now?
Well, it's a real mix of people. You definitely have those who have gone back to their homes, but they're coming back every day for supplies, for medical help, for legal aid. But you also have those residents that are still here that haven't been able to go home. And for them, it's a very bleak picture. They're homeless. They've got disabilities. These are people that have been struggling since way before the storm, and these are issues that have just been compounded. They've been trying to get back on their feet before, and they've just been knocked back down.
Marcia, the federal officials here in Washington have said that people should not have feared to go to shelters. People who needed food, water, shelter should not have worried about an immigration roundup. They said they would not be asked their immigration status. Are people trusting that?
There is a lot of fear. I spoke to one woman today who lives in an apartment complex, and she was here getting some supplies for people in that building. She told me that there had been some undocumented workers in her apartment complex that had been evicted because they'd been unable to pay their rent. They hadn't been able to work during the storm. Of course, they're too afraid to come here for supplies, for shelter, and for that necessary legal aid. So this is an issue that's definitely on the minds of the lawyers who are volunteering here. Of course, they're trying to help those immigrants who still have cases pending. And, you know, of course, if they don't have a home for their summons to appear in court to plead their case, if they can't receive that summons, then they may be penalized for failure to appear.
Marcia Biggs in Houston, thank you very much.
Thank you.
We are closely tracking a record-breaking Hurricane Irma, the most powerful Atlantic Ocean storm ever recorded. And we're still learning about the impact from Harvey in Texas and Louisiana. The healthcare system has certainly been disrupted there. As NPR's Rebecca Hersher reports, clinics that offer methadone and other opioid addiction therapies are just getting back up and running.
Stormy Trout is waiting for a ride, sitting on a hot curb outside an opioid treatment clinic in North Houston.
You know, cravings and anxiety, like, it's just treacherous. It really is.
As the city flooded last week, Trout was going through opioid withdrawal at a detox center surrounded by water.
I'm like, I know I can do this, but I just need something to help with the cravings and the anxiety and stuff.
That something is methadone, but she had to wait until Tuesday to start. Clinics all over the region that dispense methadone, buprenorphine, and other drug treatments for people addicted to opioids were cut off or flooded themselves for most of the week. The one she went to, called Texas Clinic, was stranded by water for days. Now they're cleaning the carpets and playing strangely appropriate music in the waiting room. Farouk Shamsi is the director. He made sure someone was there every day of the storm. And good thing, some people who rely on methadone to function did extraordinary things to get there.
They were very creative. We had people that parked 5 miles away and walked. They started in the morning. They got here really late. We medicated them. Then they were going to walk all the way back to their car so they could get back home.
He says Houston is a gateway for illicit drugs, including heroin, And anecdotally, he's seeing something unexpected after the storm.
What the storm did, it is caused the illegal drug network supply to be shut off. It could not get here, right? So the best thing to do is why not try something legal? And so this is a good thing, actually, in a way. Silver lining in a cloud is that people could actually come in here and get treatment for the first time and make their lives better and actually get off of drugs when they were maybe thinking about it, but now they're forced to get off of drugs.
Shamsi says this week is a recovery week for his clinic, being fully open, trying to get back to a more normal schedule, and handling patients who come from the shelters that are still open. On Tuesday morning, the mental health team at the George R. Brown Convention Center arrived to find a line of about 20 people.
These are evacuees who are coming off of drugs for the first time, or they've been in and out of recovery before, and they've been using this whole time and now are really, truly detoxing.
Dr. Crystal Collier is a psychologist at the Council on Recovery, who's been volunteering at the big shelters for days. She says for people struggling with opioid addiction who are flooded out of their homes, the shelters can only do so much.
If you're detoxing or if you need to get a Suboxone treatment or a methadone treatment, it's going to be impossible to get it at a shelter.
That's because public shelters generally don't prescribe opioid treatments on site. It's partly because people need to be screened relatively carefully to make sure they're getting the right therapy.
I mean, so many people just showed up with what they had in their hands because it happened so quickly. And so we're having to help people get their birth certificate or Social Security or a card before we can actually get them into a treatment system because we've got to have proof of who they are.
Collier says the next challenge will be helping people who are uprooted and traumatized find the stability they need to avoid relapsing. Rebecca Hersher, NPR News, Houston.
The Beast in Florida.
If you are in an evacuation zone, you need to go now. Stern words of warning from Florida Governor Rick Scott, who went on to say that Hurricane Irma is a catastrophic storm like our state has never seen. Forecasters say Irma will hit Florida head-on this weekend, starting in Miami and the Keys, and then heading right up over the whole state by Monday. Nadej Green is with station WLRN in Miami. So what are your plans for just the next couple of days? How are you preparing?
So we have shutters. I'm in the North Miami-Dade region, so we're not in any evacuation zone or very close to any of the evacuation zones. So we have our shutters up and everything is boarded and we're going to ride out the storm from home.
You were out reporting just this morning. Tell us what you've seen of Miami's preparations, or has prep kind of happened in the city slowly turning into a ghost town?
Some areas have definitely turned into a ghost town. So Miami Beach is definitely more of a ghost town than some of the other more inland areas. People are taking this very seriously. Gas stations were running out of gas 2 days ago. Governor Rick Scott has actually ordered the Highway Patrol escort fuel trucks to gas stations so that they can get there quickly, because all around Florida, people are evacuating, people are heading north. So there's a lot of traffic happening right now for people who are trying to get out of the state.
Now, I've seen reports that the homeless can't or won't leave, and also especially vulnerable are immigrant communities. A lot of people just don't have the money to leave. And we actually spoke with one woman from Jamaica named Alicia Dion, who is currently in that situation.
I'm feeling nerves. I'm feeling stressed about this situation and getting folks to understand what I mean when I say we can't leave, or it's just not as accessible as they think it is. You know, with flights being priced at $1,000 for a one-way ticket, it's not a reality that a lot of people can entertain.
All right. So that's Miami resident Alicia Dion. Nadej Green, I suspect you've met a lot of people who can't shell out that kind of money. What kind of help are people getting now?
So it's two parts. So within the homeless population right now, for the homeless who say that they won't go into shelters, they may potentially be Baker Acted, which is you're taken to a hospital. So that is a possibility. And also when we're talking about who don't have anywhere to go, people who don't have anywhere to go, the working poor is definitely a part of that conversation. So there's no pre-storm aid. There's no one going around to make sure that you have food and flashlights. Many people have told me that, well, they just paid their rent. So they don't have any extra money to go out and prep for the storm. So we do have a significant portion of our population, many, many families who will not have the resources that they need when the storm hits.
And as I indicated earlier, many of them are immigrant communities. It's also my understanding that some immigrants who are undocumented are understandably worried about going to shelters and revealing their status. How are those concerns being addressed?
Miami-Dade Mayor Carlos Jimenez has made it clear that no one is going to be checking for your immigration status if you were to go to one of the county shelters. That said, there is a very significant amount of fear in the immigrant community right now, especially in this political climate. And so I know many of the nonprofits and more grassroots organizations have actually been putting out feelers within their circles to ask families who might have extra room if they were willing to take in families versus going through the traditional shelter system as an option.
Nadege, with all the warnings to evacuate, why are you staying and riding out the storm?
Well, for me, leaving is not really an option. I don't really have another place to go. I cannot just pack up with two kids and get on a plane. I'm also a journalist here in Miami-Dade County, and I cover this community. So this is where I'm going to be.
I gather you've got one more plywood panel to nail up on your house. You still need to have a door in and out. When do you nail down that last panel?
That last panel will probably go up tomorrow. We are expecting tropical storm level winds by probably tomorrow afternoon.
Well, we wish you the best of luck and stay safe. Nadege Green in Miami at WLRN. Thanks very much for your time.
Thank you, Marco.
Context of white supremacy. Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Saturday, September 9th, 2017. So I have been told. This is our weekly compensatory call-in. If you would like to dial in, commentary, questions, suggestions, the number to dial, 641-715-3640. The code 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. Before we get started, I think last week, both on some of my social media pages, as well as on the program, I reminded folks that we have a substantial number of listeners and guests who've been on this program over the years in the Texas area. That is true, even people who live directly in the Houston area. We also have a substantial number of listeners in the Florida area, listeners and investors. Just reams of them. I think Florida has easily been one of the states where we've had a substantial number of listeners from day one, people that call in, participate on a regular basis. InterstandingBusiness.com also has a broadcast right here at Black Talk Radio Network. She's been a guest on the program, longtime investor, retired firefighter down in the Florida area. I'm trying to think. Princess, she's called in numerous times over the years. It's just reams of folks that we have. Regular folks, voices that I think you've heard often are down in Florida. I think our caller who works at the courthouse who's called in, he has the racist colleague who likes to take the battery out of the remote control and leave it on Fox. He's called in over and down in Florida. We just have a lot of folks. Listeners and even some of our guests, Dr. Marvin Dunn, The Beast in Florida, his book about the history of anti-black violence in Florida, just tons of folks. I hope if I didn't mention you directly, it's just because we have so many. Just trying to think as someone asked me about one of our listeners and then I stopped like, wow, it's just a huge number of Cal's listeners that are down there. I hope folks evacuated. I hope you were able to get someplace safe. Dry while all of this is happening. Take it very seriously. And not just the storm. Same thing. I think we talked about this last time. This came up with Hurricane Katrina and there's historical evidence that this has been done repeatedly. Anytime where you have these kind of breakdowns, right, where it's a storm and so police might not be able to respond to things and you just kind of have general disorder. That is an opportunity generally for racists to really take advantage and terrorize black people. We've seen that, and that can happen in a variety of different ways. So just anytime there's a situation like this, I think it's best if you have the means, the resources, go ahead, play it safe, get to a safe spot, see, you know, how things play out, and then you can head home, head back to the house after things are calm. I certainly understand, as was discussed in the last clip, the system of white supremacy is designed so that you have substantial numbers of non-white people where that is not an option. They don't have those type of resources, and they're just going to be stuck and just hoping for the best, certainly. But if you can, man, if you chose to stay or that wasn't an option, I hope you all down in Florida were able to get to a safe spot. We will definitely be thinking, praying for you all over the next few days and weeks, as well as folks in Houston as they continue to deal with the wreckage. But just, man, it's been a summer of all of these events. The thing that happened over in Nepal, where I think they had about 1,200 people to die with flooding. I think that was mostly non-white people. They had that massive earthquake in Mexico. It's just been a lot of different catastrophes. And generally what's going to happen is non-white people are going to suffer the worst in all these different events. But if we have any folks in the Florida area, if you want to chime in and give us, you know, what you have been seeing, if you chose to evacuate, if you chose to leave, if you just want to let folks know that you are one of our Florida listeners and, you know, are maintaining, that would be great. I'm sure folks would enjoy hearing from you. One thing that I will say, connected with all of the hurricane Irma and the situation down in Florida, I was checking just to see if the looting hysteria had started in Florida, if they were going to have, you know, for, oh my God, the Negroes are looting butter in Florida, it's running back, to see if that was happening. The first, one of the first articles that I saw, it was an arrest in Florida. It was a white man that they showed where he was already arrested for looting. That made my day. I laughed and laughed. I don't even know if I got it posted on Facebook, but I made that the image for the compensatory call-in. So I don't know if I posted the actual article. I will do that. I was so excited that I was just taking screenshots as I chuckled and tried not to spill my beverage. But that did make my day, and you know, folks can be alert for that sort of thing as well. Number one issue, as I said, addressing lots of Cal's listeners, Florida, Texas, their well-being. Two, we have not, the Cal's, been on for a week. We did not do the book club yesterday. We did not do workplace racism. I was feeling substantially better. I had a bevy of injuries. My back had been hurting for about a month, but that was doing substantially better this week. I felt like, oh, wow, I'm finally recouping. I went out and was doing walks and just feeling way, way better. And my wisdom teeth, I got the first two extracted. It was about 10 days ago, middle of last week. So I had that as a problem as well. Those are feeling better. I was able to eat solid food, but the other two wisdom teeth, they were scheduled to be extracted on Tuesday. So I was thinking that next week, you know, might be a little touch and go, have to see how it is. They contacted me and said that they could move the appointment up and that I could be done. I would not have to see them again and just have all of this done and be healed, particularly since the side that they had already done had healed and didn't have a lot of difficulty. So I went ahead to get that procedure done Thursday. So that, you know, eliminated any prospect I had planned. If you saw, I already had posted the description for the workplace racism program, but then I found out after I got that posted that, oh, I'm going to be getting my final two wisdom teeth removed on the past Thursday. So I'm not going to be able to talk and the following Friday either. In fact, I looked at the instructions from the dentist and what they normally recommend. They generally recommend a week off. So technically we shouldn't have been broadcasting today either, but I did not feel too bad. I am medicated. I even got a prescription this time around, which I did not fill. There was a report that I did not play. I had the audio for it, but they were talking about the opioid epidemic and they were saying that dentists in the United States, that they are a critical component of this
opioid epidemic, getting all of these white addicts running mad that you just heard about. But they were saying that dentists, they prescribe a lot of, obviously, you have a lot of people that come to the dentist in pain. And then depending on your procedure and what have you, you could leave in pain. And so they end up prescribing a lot of Vicodin, opioids, to patients. And they were saying, they didn't say white people. As much as they've said that this opioid epidemic is totally a white problem, this segment, they didn't say white people, but they just said that people have gotten so skillful that they're like professionals at being able to go and, oh, I got a toothache. Oh, I need to get this tooth extracted. Oh, oh, oh. And they get their prescription and then just go and refill and refill and refill and use the system and get, you know, all 100 or so pills and divvy it up amongst their friends and all this other stuff. But it was real extensive on how that right there, I didn't even fill my prescription because I'm just not on that medication stuff anyway. I said I wanted to see if, you know, I can just manage with a little over-the-counter ibuprofen, and that has been the case. So, yeah, I can say that, yes, the opioid thing is for real, and I guess if you just whine enough, you can go, particularly if you are white, you can just go in, whine a little bit, and they will dope you up as much as you like. Continuing, but all of that to say, I'm feeling better today. Hopefully I will be even better a week from now. Before a week from now, we should be back on Monday. I thought when it was just the back that I was dealing with, I thought I would be fine at the beginning of the month. Little did I know all the wisdom tooth extractions were going to be happening to cause a whole nother broadcasting difficulty. But I think all of that is done and we should be back to a reasonably normal schedule. 9/11. This Monday, Dr. Martin Kevorkian, speaking of guests in the Texas area, he is in Austin. Dr. Martin Kevorkian, admitted white supremacists, should be back on the cows, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. If you want to prep the four films we will be discussing, in addition to if he has commentary on what has been going down in his state over the last 2-3 weeks. But the four films we'll be discussing, The Place Beyond the Pines, came out in 2013. The Big Lebowski, came out in 1998. Little Boxes, film I have been talking about all summer long. Nelson Ellis, the late Nelson Ellis, died at 39. Little Boxes came out in 2016. And I Don't Feel at Home in This World Anymore, came out this year, 2017. That is a double dip on Melanie Lynskey, suspected racist, born in New Zealand. She was in the last two films mentioned. The asterisk of all of those, The Big Lebowski. That would be the one I'm most looking forward to talking about. Very old or reasonably old film. That is the one I'm most looking forward to discussing. It. Incidentally, that is the only film Dr. Kevorkian had seen on that list. The rest of them he hadn't seen, hadn't heard of. So that'll be a hoot coming this Monday, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific, 9/11. Grand. One other quick thing, make sure I get in before we get to some of the folks who dialed. They had a report on Overton. If I don't know if retired firefighter is listening or not. He's one of our folks down in the Florida area, hoping he and the rest of them are safe. But we've talked about Overton. This area has a lot of black people. We've had reports. I think Leonita McLean mentioned the Overton area and racism that black residents there were facing in Florida in the 1980s, like for years. Retired firefighter has brought it up. We talked about it all the time. They had a report today where specifically in Overton, they were saying that the residents, I've never been to Overton specifically. I've been to Miami. I've been to Florida repeatedly. I went to Disney World multiple times. But I've never been to Overton. I assume, based on what they said, that it's mostly black people. The report they showed today also had black people pictured. And specifically, it was black people looking confused. And the title of the report was Overton Residents Being Given Confusing Information. And it was talking about they were, I'm not even sure if Overton is in the evacuation area, but this is southern Florida, so I would think they would have to be. Anyway, they say that some of the residents were told you could go to shelter A, you could go here if you don't feel safe in your residence, you know, wind, water, whatever the problem might be, you could go here. Others were told you could not go there. Others were told you could go here. And I said, oh, man, have we not heard this before? That sounds super familiar to me, all the work that we did on Hurricane Katrina, where people are getting bad information about what black people specifically are being given bad information. Oh, yeah, you can just go and walk across the Crescent City Bridge. No problem. And then you get there and you got armed officers pointing guns at you like, get the hell away from here. You can't come to that town. Get away or we'll shoot you. This is what I mean about when these storms and these type of events happen where things kind of break down and it's chaos, confusion, martial law almost type situation. It's really, really helpful, particularly for victims of white supremacy, black people. Extraordinarily helpful if you can kind of coordinate in advance. We've had programs about this. Particularly, I'd say if you have a family, man, you should talk about this in advance. If you live in areas where they have hurricanes, Gusty Renegade is at the top of the list because Seattle, not only do they have hurricanes here, they have earthquakes, we're on a fault line, we're close to a volcano, like everything that could possibly go wrong is here. So these are things that should be talked about. You know, are we going to evacuate, having your little bag already packed together? Talk about and plan if we're going to stay. Are we going to try and get to one specific spot? Maybe there's a hotel that's at high ground where we can stay there. Or if we have friends, family, something. Already have your plan together because, man, if you have to be in a position to rely on racists to get you life-saving information in a short period of time, oh, man, you talk about confusion. You could just expect there's probably going to be some confusion and some bad information where it'll be whoops, and it might be too late after the whoops. If you have information, suggestions, thoughts you would like to share, the number again, 641-715-3640. The code 564-943-pound. Press *6 if you would like to participate. We are listener supported at the Cows. If you would like to invest, check the blog racism-notes.blogspot.com, racism-notes.blogspot.com. PayPal button is in the top right corner. If you're not into PayPal, drop us an email. We'll get you a physical mailing address. Huge thanks to all the folks who have supported, invested. Thank you. I hope the Cows has been worthy of your time and energy. Folks who got things for us off our wish list at Amazon.com. It's under Gus T. Renegade. Thanks for the support there as well. Folks said you should really make sure you mention that with all of your extractions. People might feel bad for you. And visit the wish list, Amazon.com, Gus T. Renegade. But I am feeling substantially better thanks to all the folks who have inquired and questioned the well wishes. Much obliged. And hopefully now we'll be moving forward. I don't have to go back to the dentist for at least a good 3 months. Final thing I will say, just make sure that people don't think it has been all gloom and doom for Gus T over the past month, really. Yesterday, pals and I, we went to do a sensory deprivation tank. They have these little cool, this is like the new rage out here at the spas and relaxation ports. And Seattle is a super white city. They have lots of little interesting places like this in Seattle. So we went to do the sensory deprivation tank. And it's supposed to be very relaxing, which I was super looking forward to since I was only a day removed from my wisdom tooth extraction. And you get in this tank salt water so you float very easily. No light, no sound. They give you earplugs and you just float. Float for 90 minutes. They have shorter sessions. You can float for 60, but ours was 90. And you're just in complete darkness. Can't see anything. You can't hear anything. You can't smell anything. You're just floating in water. And the water is warmed to about 93 degrees. It's roughly the same temperature as the surface of your skin. So after you've been in the water for about 5-10 minutes, it's kind of difficult to tell where your body stops and the water begins because it's really about the same. It's very warm. So anyway, so you just sit there and you're supposed to relax. I'd heard about it before, but I had never read any details and had certainly never even thought about going to try it myself. I would recommend. I think number one, just because we're constantly being bombarded by white supremacy programming, I think just sitting quietly, I think a psychiatrist that used to chat it up with us used to talk about the value of sitting quietly, calming your mind, that you can think constructively. The creator might even send you some signals to help solve some of our problems. I think a psychiatrist we used to chat it up with used to talk about that. Maybe I'm in error. Anyway, I would recommend it. Just, I think the system of white supremacy, I think particularly for victims, they just try to have us constantly bombarded by stimulus, you know, huge television and loud music and loud TV and loud noise and traffic and pollution and just everything. To just be able to get to a point where you're calm, you're not being interrupted, there's no cell phone going off, it's nobody to talk to, it's nothing to look at, where you can just sit and think. Calm your mind. Nothing to look at. You can just chill out. Doesn't matter if you open your eyes or close them, it's going to be total darkness either way. So you can just sit and calm. I would recommend, I think the other folks that I went with, all non-white, I don't think they enjoyed it as much, but it's not quite like going to get a massage, right? It's not quite like going and just hanging out, you know, if you're going to go to the spa or something else, because you're not talking to somebody else. It's not like going on a roller coaster or going to an amusement park or something like that. But I do think there are lots of benefits. I think even scratching all the sensory deprivation, being in Epsom salt, I think that's beneficial in and of itself. I think people have been doing that for like hundreds and hundreds of years, unless I'm misinformed. That in and of itself is great. But then the sensory deprivation aspect, I think, also is healthy. I also think it's one of those things that is good for you, even though you might not realize it immediately. That was my initial impression from doing it the first time. I would recommend doing it. We will stop there. For this broadcast exclusively, I would request if we could not use metaphors. It's been my experience that often in conversations on racism, whites, they will use a lot of metaphors. They will compare, use analogies and comparisons between two items that are not equivalent at all. They'll do this all the time, and it's done as a deliberate way of practicing racism to cause confusion, like I said before, to be deceptive. Non-white people, victims of racism, we've been exposed to a lot of this incorrect behavior, and unfortunately, a lot of us, Gusty Renegade included, we are still learning. So sometimes we haven't come to a conclusion. Often we will use a metaphor to convey our thoughts on an idea and hope that that accurately conveys what we're thinking. Frequently, it does not. It just adds to the confusion where things are not clear. If you could be direct, explicit with what it is that you want to say, that would be super appreciated. I will prompt about that. Also, if you know you're in a noisy environment, if you could turn or just use your mute button, that would be great. That would help preserve the quality of the broadcast. When you know you want to speak, just unmute and you can, you know, share whatever thoughts you have and then mute your line again. That way, you know, we don't have all that extra noise interrupting on the program. With that, we will go ahead and get to folks who dialed in. If you could take 5 minutes to share your thoughts, views, commentary, that would be great. Make sure everybody gets an opportunity to share. First few folks who dialed in with a hand up, line should be open. I almost feel like I would privilege the folks, callers, if they're in the Florida area, if you want to check in with your reports, or even, as I said, just to check in to let folks know that you are doing okay for the time being. Definitely want to hear from folks down there. If you have a hand up, line should be open. Proceed.
Can I be heard?
Retired firefighter in Florida. Good to hear from you, sir.
I am still alive. Greetings, everyone. Just wanted to report on the happenings down here in South Florida. I think I heard you, Gus, mention something about, you pronounced it Overton, but it's properly known as Overtown. Yeah. So am I. What was your report on Overtown about the confusion?
Yes, sir. That they were that the residents were being given incorrect or confusing information about where to evacuate to, how to get there. I can actually give you all the exact report. It was from WLRN. This is a local Florida public radio affiliate, and the exact report: Overtown residents get mixed messages about open shelters ahead of Hurricane Irma.
Yeah, well, I would say first and foremost is that I didn't see the article yet, but actually it's more widespread, which is not surprising. It's more widespread than just the Overtown area. Overtown is just uniqueness about Overtown is that it is the first area where large numbers of non-white black people were allowed to stay in the South Florida area known as the city of Miami, primarily because they were the ones who physically, the black males, in their, which in turn is connected with, he is connected with their, his families, built the railroad down here in the South Florida, Miami area. So they had to give them a place to stay in order to do their slave work, but that's where Overtown, the origins of it came from. But anyway, yes, I'm not surprised about it. One of the known stories down here was the governor, suspected racist, of the state of Florida ordered mandatory evacuations from areas that were identified by the alphabets A, B, and C. Most of the people from the quote-unquote A area is from the Key West portion of the state of Florida, which as you look at the state of Florida as the numeral 7, that's what the state of Florida looks like. And underneath the lower part of the state of Florida, it's actually called a peninsula. Described as peninsula, you would see something that looks like a tail. Those are the islands that is called Key West. And that's primarily a group A. Group B would be the people that are close to the ocean line areas on the eastern side of the state of Florida, the lower eastern side of the state of Florida. And the C groups are areas where the land is lower than a lot of the water, meaning that it doesn't take a long time for the water to go above your head in some cases. Now, to make a long story short, that resulted into about 650,000 people. I repeat myself, 650,000 people. Now, the main facility of evacuations just about everywhere is what? Public schools. I'm pretty sure that there are less than 300,000 students that go to Miami-Dade County Public Schools. So that tells you what, by just doing the math, it would be impossible for 650,000 people to be even put in the schools. So where are all these people going to go? First of all, 99% of them, probably 99% of them would be non-white people, with a large majority of those people being non-white people who are racially classified as black. So you wouldn't have anywhere from them. I remember seeing on the television white person whose primary language is Spanish, although she wasn't speaking Spanish, interviewing people on her news report and literally admonishing these non-white black people on why do they show up here to this evacuation location. One of them was a black female who was transporting by foot her child in a baby carriage. No telling how far she walked. And
admonishing her. Why did you wait till the last minute? Why did you wait the last minute to show up here? You know, as though she knew her life story or something. You know, that sort of thing. Whereas talking to the white people, it would be more or less like, oh, you found the place to go to, huh? That's great. And now you're safe. You know, that sort of thing. So it was, to me, you know, deliberate acts of racist white supremacy that was being practiced and still being practiced as I speak, you know, on the issue. And it's just fortunate that the direction of the hurricane is not going in an area where it can be much more catastrophic to people and places than that was originally thought of to happen. It's switching more to the western part of Florida and the Gulf of Mexico, and it hasn't yet even turned north. If you look at the state of Florida as the number seven, it's just at the lower end in that body of water. It's scathing off of the northern part of Cuba. And more to, and it just off of the offshore from Cuba, and it hasn't even went north yet, but it's exactly just below the state of Florida. At some point in time, they are expecting it to go north. Hopefully, it will go north in the water on the western side of the state of Florida. And the retired firefighter and millions of other people would miss the devastation possibilities that take place in something of this magnitude. And unless I have some questions, which I may be prepared to answer, I would turn it over to somebody else. Thank you.
Good to hear from you, retired fighter. Like I said, I know folks were concerned about you all, because a lot of listeners, they know you and many other folks are down there. So we will be praying and thinking about you over the next few days. And hopefully it will head towards the water and you all will miss all of that devastation. And just to echo the point about the Overtown residents, what was happening, I'm not going to read the full report, but just to give you a little bit, it says in Miami's Overtown community, some families are receiving conflicting reports about the nearest shelter they could go to. And this is to firefighters' point about the schools being used. At the New Arena Court apartments, tenants had hurricane warning letters posted on their doors from the building's management. For people who wanted to go to a shelter, it directed them to Booker T. Washington High School, a short walk from your building. However, an email bulletin from Miami City Commissioner Keon Hardiman to constituents Thursday stated the high school would not be used as a shelter due to roof conditions. The email prominently features a canceled state of the district address, and in smaller text notes, the school will not be a shelter. It does not direct residents to any other shelter. It's Overtown, just skipping a little bit. Overtown is one of Miami-Dade's poorest neighborhoods. Many of the residents don't have cars or are elderly and need help transporting items to a shelter. I suspect a lot of these folks are black as well, but it doesn't say that in the report.
Yes, yes, there. Yes, it is. He's actually a second cousin of mine.
Oh, well.
The commissioner.
Right on. I'm sure they'll do some blaming and say it was all his fault to begin with. Wow.
Oh, right.
God, Mr. Hardiman told you all wrong. He doesn't care about you all. That no good Mr. Hardiman. The other folks, if you're with us, if you have commentary, feel free. I think Mr. Firefighter said folks had a question. Feel free as well.
Yeah.
Other folks who dialed in with a hand up, did you have commentary? Other folks who dialed in with a hand up?
Hello, may I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Hello, thank you for taking my call. Hello, everyone. This is Red in Ohio. I first wanted to thank the retired firefighter for giving us his views about what's going on with Hurricane Irma. Actually have the Weather Channel on, and, you know, they have their nonstop coverage. And I'm glad that, like I said, he gave his input on it, because it seems like from the Weather Channel, you would think that, you know, the whole of South Florida, so basically that bottom part of the seven would just be, I don't know, underwater. Maybe I'm just...
Ooh, Lord.
Oh.
Sorry about that.
Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Oh, okay. All right, thank you. So just wanted to say first thank you to the retired firefighter. A little bit of the... local news here in Ohio. And again, I usually have comments about the Columbus Dispatch. So this week actually is one of the first weeks where the front page news on the Columbus Dispatch has not been about the opioid epidemic or something closely linked to it, whether it's, you know, the Narcan or portraying some recovering addict story. This time, however, it's kind of equally as depressing, I guess you would say. The title of the article says Trump lends a hand, and it's basically talking about the Hurricane Harvey recovery, and it features a big picture. I'm sure this picture could probably be found different places, but it features a big picture with the president and his wife and the first lady, and there's two children. One looks to be I think that he would be accepted as a white man, a young white man. And then the other boy is a black male, a really young black male. And the president has his hands in the article underneath the article describing the picture. It says that the president is cupping the little boy's face, and then they give him a high five. But it kind of almost seems like it's definitely, to me, it seems like it's rehearsed. It's kind of like, you know, I really don't want to have to touch this little Negro, but let me try to just put on a nice act and a smile for the camera. I feel very bad for that, for the child. The only other thing that I wanted to say about the commentary, I'm sorry, about the clips. I actually tried to listen to some talk radio here in Ohio, and there was one talk radio show. They were speaking about the Mr. Bennett issue, the football player. Of course, it was a horrible talk radio show, and I feel like it was a white male a host, basically just describing how the football player, he was guilty. I appreciate like the segment where I also saw the picture or the little clip where from the other law enforcement officials, body camera showing that the person, the possible white Latino officer did have his gun to Mr. Bennett's head. And while he was in handcuffs, It's definitely not surprising to me. When I lived in Las Vegas, it's definitely, I witnessed that firsthand. I thought that it would, the clip about the Miami reporter, how even she couldn't leave and she was even a reporter, it definitely helps me better understand that, you know, evacuating, because I've never had to evacuate anywhere. But evacuating is just not something that, you know, even if you might have more money. And it also made me think about possibly workplace racism. If she's a reporter and cannot evacuate, that could possibly be, you know, she might not be getting paid as much as the reporters who are considered white. Yeah, but that definitely helps me understand that, you know, it's not just possibly about money. And I did appreciate Dr. Bullard's commentary about the environmental racism in Houston. It also did make me think about Hurricane Katrina and how the environmental scientists during Katrina, how they did not call it. They said that, you know, it wasn't water that the people had to wade through. They called it toxic sludge. I guess that is
all for now. Thank you for allowing me to share.
Indeed, indeed. Other folks who dialed in with a hand up, line should be open. Proceed.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir. Greetings, Ross. I got my oregano oil extract, the mesh tea ball, and the wild lettuce tea. Oh, I got the colloidal silver and the spray bottle. I've been taking my oregano oil and the tea and rinsing my mouth with the colloidal silver since I've had my final extractions done.
Wonderful. I'm glad to hear that. I just hope you heal exponentially fast. I'm glad to hear you are back on the air, too. I missed you the past few times that you weren't unable to do the show. So I'm really, really glad to have you back, and I'm sure I'm not the only one. Yes, I'm happy that you're healing. Like I said, I hope it happens really fast with the colloidal silver. I did send you a few articles so you can really, like, get a richer understanding of how potent it really is and the wonderful things that it does for the human body, especially for us as Black people. So I'm just glad you got it. And first, I wanted to say I'm really glad the firefighter and fought a call, because he was the first person that popped on my mind when I saw the information about Hurricane Irma touching down on Florida. I just actually saw that it's taking a different trajectory than what they thought, and it's actually now heading northwest. That just came out. I just saw it right before I came on the show to listen. And it's just really just good to hear his voice. I hope that everyone else from the Florida area is safe as well. I didn't remember Princess was from Florida, but I did remember the Black male who has the terrorist Fox News coworker. I thought about him as well. So I just hope that everyone in that region, in that whole area, I just hope that they're okay, because it's going to be affecting a wide area. It's just a huge storm. So I hope everything works out for everyone, where their homes aren't affected, and that they're able to go back and get back to their normal lives. That's something that's been of a major concern of mine. So I just wanted to say that first. To jump into the clips, this is very interesting. And I did want to just throw a fact out there about Kermit. When you talked about the opioid epidemic, Kermit, West Virginia, there's a documentary series called Intervention. And I saw an ad for an upcoming episode, and they deal specifically with addicts. I would say like 95 to 98% of them are white. And a lot of it deals with the opioid epidemic. And they had an ad for an upcoming program that said in Kermit, West Virginia, and this was just a couple of years ago, I forget what year they said, but they said they had over 9 million opioid-based pills sent to Kermit, West Virginia, to one specific pharmacy in 2 years. And these were all prescribed by the same doctor and processed by the same pharmacist. So this is to tell you how organized the drug trade is, and the legal drug trade, to get these white people high and keep them perpetually in a state of drug-induced stupidity. So I just wanted to just put that out there, because it's just very fascinating when I saw that information. And as you talked about it, it also made me think about that situation, because it deeply resonates across the country. And this is probably what it looks like in a lot of other places, too. But we're not being told. So I just wanted to say that. Also, I thought about the clip you had about the Black female senator who said that President Trump should be assassinated. And she just really learned in the hardest way possible how the system of white supremacy works. And it was really hard for me to hear her try to dissipate the sheer horrific attacks that she's been under just for making this statement publicly. Again, I just think it just speaks to us being codified and really watching what we say and how we say things, because the repercussions can be really, really huge. And it was just hard for me to listen to her have to suffer through all of that apologizing and just trying to justify the reason why she shouldn't lose her job. And to me, even though the other senator, they were talking about equal treatment, that will never be the case. He's white, and he's a white male even more so. she's black and she's a black female. So as a result, she's going to be treated like black people are treated. He's going to be treated like white people are treated, which means more than likely he's not going to get in any trouble. He might just get verbally reprimanded and that's it. And she might lose her career, sadly. So I hope things work out for her. But yeah, I think it's a great example of why codification is so just abundantly important. Just to return to the opioid clip, I just thought about the levels that white people go through to get their drugs when they described in the middle of this storm, these white people parking their car 5 miles away and walking 5 miles to get their drugs and then walking 5 miles back to their car. That is just incredulous, you know, because we've heard, and I know I grew growing up, I've heard stories even from drug addicts with crackheads where they talk about what's known as crackhead feet. And it's that their feet get literally mangled from walking all the time, looking for that perpetual next high to make them feel like the first time. So me growing up hearing about, you know, crackhead feet and how they go through this, you know, these long excursions to get, you know, as high as they can, kind of made me think of this. And just with white people, just the extent that they're able to, you know, levels they're able to go through to get their drugs. And then the white reporter said something interesting. He said there was a silver lining, and the silver lining was the stopping the illicit drug trade in the area. And silver is considered a white metal, so it's funny when they use the term silver lining, I took it as meaning fair, or in some way implying white, and white meaning good. So I just wanted to put that out there because he did use that metaphor in regards to the stopping the illicit drug trade, but it caused these addicts such discomfort not having access to heroin. They would walk 5 miles, or really 10 miles, to get and retrieve their drugs and go back home to use them. So I thought that was interesting. I wanted to ask you about the clip on Dr. J. Marion Sims. What did they say, because I missed that part, where in New York City it was located?
I think that statue's in Central Park. Double check. But...
Central Park. Okay. No problem. It makes sense to me. Yeah, I just think that he should not get any sort of accolades. He's a terrorist, and he's just the highest practitioner of medical apartheid. Even on the radio show I do, I read the Hippocratic Oath, and just the Hippocratic Oath speaks to the upright character that doctors are supposed to have and how they're not supposed to abuse their patients. Matter of fact, in the Hippocratic Oath, they pay homage to Imhotep by the name of Asclepius. So they're actually paying homage to an African deity from the Nile Valley who was actually a living human being, who was a multi-genius. So you're paying homage to a black person, and you literally practice medical apartheid on all of your black patients, and you get a statue. And what I remembered reading in medical apartheid was that the white women that he did the surgery on, he did have anesthesia for them. But it was the black ones he purposefully did not use anesthesia for. So I found that to be quite facetious that they did not put that in the article, because I do remember reading that in medical apartheid that he did use anesthesia on his white female patients after he practiced on these black female patients with slaves, really, without any anesthesia whatsoever. So, yes, this is, I think, is in regards to J. Marion Sims, I think it's great to remove it. But then on the flip side, I'm also thinking that maybe it should remain so that black people understand when they go into these medical establishments, the type of things that he did are the type of things we can expect. So in that regard, I think it should stay. But as far as just the fact that he's being honored for practicing the highest form of racial terror, you know, in regards to the medical practice, you know, I think it should be removed. So I'm kind of 50-50 on that. Also, what you discussed about meditation and sensory deprivation, I found to be quite fascinating. I've been a practitioner of comedic spirituality for like 23, 24 years, and I've been that a high part of that is meditation. And when I meditate, that's exactly what I do. I practice sensory deprivation. There's no lights, unless it's the light of a candle, complete silence. Every now and then I might use meditative music, comedic meditative music, or other meditative music. And the act of being silent is so essential. Dr. Welsing was the person who reiterated that quite often. And I believe from what I've understood around surrounding her passing, a large part of the reason that she ended up losing her life was the lack of silence due to that Jewish school. And they cut the trees down that were the sound buffer between her property and their property. and that agitated her mentally and spiritually. So the importance of that silence, like you said, sometimes people may not necessarily understand it in the moment, but the healing properties and the ability to tap into higher states of consciousness to potentially, like you said, solve problems is something I've personally experienced. So I must just reiterate that and advocate that for as many people who are within earshot. So thanks again for a great program. Again, I'll mute my line and let someone else speak. And hopefully I'll get a chance to chime in later if other people make comments that that give me the thoughts and ideas to speak again. Thanks again, and I'm glad you're starting to feel better. Continue to heal quickly. I'll mute my line. Thank you.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Awesome. Am I being heard clearly?
So far, yes, sir.
So far. Perfect. This is Ken Steele, and I'm in Chino, California at the moment. And I just wanted to say that I'm glad to hear that our participants from Florida are doing all right. I have a brother, a little brother who's, I guess, in some sort of medical school down there. And he successfully evacuated and went to Atlanta for a bit. And then he went back to Michigan, where I'm originally from, and my family is currently based. So, I really am hoping the best for those who have opted to stay in their homes and ride out the storm. To me, that is probably not the best decision, just from the looks of things. But I really hope that everything works out for anybody who is still down there. This week, I just wanted to touch on a little workplace racism that I've been made aware of that has occurred in my I guess respective market for comedy. Recently, a comedian who is a victim of racism was invited to perform at a mic of some sort at a venue called The Red Cove in Ventura, California. And this victim, apparently after his set, was invited to take a picture with a suspected racist female, and a suspected racist male saw this interaction occurring and decided to intervene rather violently. And allegedly, I guess, this comedian was punched in the face, sucker punched, what he described, punched in the face, and called the N-word several times throughout this whole interaction. And this victim went ahead and reported this incident to people on Facebook. I initially saw this reported in a Facebook posting, and then there was another posting about it, and then there was the a video that was made about this incident. And I know that all victims have DGQ, however, something struck me as rather odd about the reaction that this victim was having. I suggested that this victim go ahead and report this incident to the authorities. And, I was quickly rebuffed. I was told by several people involved that, it wasn't that bad, and it was, people were drunk, and, there was every excuse that was made to make this situation acceptable. And, my question about the situation was, if this were a white female comedian and she were punched in the face and called the B word and the C word, what would happen to that mic and what would happen to that bar? And, one of the main differences that would have occurred because of you know, we live under a system of racism, white supremacy, that would have accounted for a difference. But another key difference is that there would have probably been a police report made. And, you know, this is something that I encourage all victims of racism to get familiar doing. Get familiar with filing, the process of filing a police report and reporting when crimes occur to you. Because anytime you have any of these incidences occur to you and all you do is report it on Facebook or, you know, talk about it on Facebook, it seems as though the effect that I'm seeing is that people are just bragging about getting beat up and getting harassed by racists in public, as opposed to taking constructive steps to rectify the situation and to, you know, possibly come across any sort of money in the form of damages that you're entitled to. Because if you get beat up in a place that has a liquor license, I'm, you know, if that were me, I would be, you know, filing a police report, filing, getting looked at by the hospital, contacting a personal injury attorney, and filing any sort of paperwork to get any sort of process started, because that is 100% unacceptable. And we have to start valuing our lives to the point where, hey, we are comfortable reporting these situations to the police. You know, I was talking to a former police officer who is also a victim, and he said even him, he has trouble getting it in his head that he is entitled to report crimes that are in progress, that are occurring against him. He, you know, says in his mind he wants to be an end person and, you know, take matters into his own hands. These are his words. And I imagine a lot of other victims feel that way in situations that are escalating. But you have the right and you have the ability to calmly say, hey, I'm going to call the authorities, and you can do that. I know that there's a fear that everybody, you know, that the law enforcement will show up and immediately on the scene start shooting. And in a lot of situations, that does occur. However, you can take steps to rectify that by being the person that reported the situation first, being calm when they arrive on the scene, and being prepared to identify yourself as the person who's reporting the incident. And if we don't start reporting crimes that happen to us, all that happens is that it creates an environment where the next victim of racism can be victimized by people that would go ahead and sucker punch people in these situations. So don't be afraid to report situations, and don't be afraid to admit that you're afraid for your life in these situations either. And don't be afraid to pursue any sort of action that you can take in these situations. And I'll mute my line at this time. Thank you so much.
Appreciate that, Mr. Steele. Other folks, if you are with us, the number again, 641-715-3640, the code 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes, sir. Greetings to you, the host, the callers, and the listeners. This is Imhan DC. I just wanted to say for the people who are experiencing, you know, hard times with this flood, good luck to you and be safe. I have a number of family members in those areas. And then for the African Union, I'd really like for the African states to very explicitly say something about what's going on here. You know, you can, when I was in Africa, it seemed like they didn't really know any of the history. They didn't even know what was going on during slavery. A lot of them don't even know who's a white person, who's a black person. You know, they were calling me white and I'm not white. They were calling, you know, people very dark as them, white, if they sound like they had an American accent and all that. But, you know, I'm just saying all that to say, I don't know how we can do it exactly, but we need to really get into in communication with the Africans on the continent, the people who are in charge anyway, and explain to them what's going on here. And we need something solid. We need an agreement. We need the African governments to say that they are for us and to say that they are against our common enemy. But that's all I would say. Thank you.
Appreciate that. Other folks who dialed in, if we have not heard from you, if you have a hand up, line should be open. Proceed. Did we miss folks? Seems there are other hands up, unless I am mistaken. Did we miss any folks?
Good evening, Gus. Can you hear me?
Yes, sir.
Good evening to all. Glad to hear from the firefighter. Lars said he's been on my mind. Also have a question for the firefighter and the young scholar. It's the same question if he's on the line. But I just wanted to speak on this whole incident, which is a tragedy. And just to give my little 10 cents on what I see happening. If time persists later, I would love to give my critique on what I think Antifa is and that whole thing. But just wanted to just give a good little bit of tidbits here on what I see with the storm. As well as you, Gus, I'm glad to hear from you. I'm glad that you're feeling better. It's funny you said that you have to get your ink, those teeth in the back, wisdom teeth pulled. Sorry, my headphones fell out. I had to get the same thing done coming up. So, I'm not looking forward to that. Can I still be heard?
Yes, sir.
Oh, okay, great. I was listening to the clips, but first I wanted to say, as far as the storms, it's either one or two things. Either these are weather wars, these are man-made manipulated storms caused by HAARP, SOLA, or CERN, or some other nefarious apparatus. Or, like I said before, when we had the eclipse, this is the new sun. This could be the other option. Floods historically follow eclipses. Dr. Delby Blair always predicted that a eclipse will fully usher in the Aquarian age. Aquarius, the water bearer, causing events, he would say, to expel those who have not raised their vibrations to a high enough frequency to enter the fifth dimension, which we entered in 2012. So a lot of the things he predicted, it seemed like, it's definitely coming true. Every night I go outside, I can see the Orion. I can see Cirrus, clear as day, looking like we're getting closer to those stars. But either one you choose, these hurricanes are historically an anomaly because hurricanes get their energy from water and lingering over land for multiple days, up to 5 days, and then moving hundreds of miles inland is not normal for a hurricane because what is it feeding off of? The land is there. There's no water for it to feed off of. So these hurricanes seem extremely suspect. I just want to say Houston, 2.3 million people, 650,000 people that live in Houston are black. Greater Houston area has 4.6 million people. That's Harris County. They have a gross domestic product just in Houston of $500 billion. Houston has the second most Fortune 500 companies in the United States to New York. Houston, just the city of Houston alone would be has a gross domestic product that would put it between Switzerland and Sweden if it was in Europe. It would have Europe's eighth largest economy. Texas, the state, because the hurricane was huge and it affected the whole state. Economy of $1.6 trillion. It would be Europe's fourth largest economy between Italy and Russia, or the 12th largest economy in the world behind Canada, just by itself. So this is a huge, huge area. Miami, and I did these numbers before that they predicted the storm, but I see Miami, that hurricane is so large, the whole Florida is going to be impacted. 450,000 people, 90,000 blacks living in Miami. Miami-Dade County has 2.7 million people, 580,000 black people. But there's a lot of black people in Miami, same as Houston. Miami's gross domestic product is $318, Florida's largest by far, larger than Denmark's and Israel's. Florida's gross domestic product is $928 billion, which would be the seventh largest economy in Europe. I use Europe as my backdrop because that's white people. And it would be the seventh largest economy between Spain and the Netherlands, the state of Florida. So compared to Katrina, because we did a lot of research on Katrina and read the book, New Orleans has a meager economy of $79 billion. And 450,000 people lived in New Orleans at the time of Katrina. About 320 of them were black. Today, they have a total of only 340,000 people, only 200,000 blacks. The state of Louisiana, even though it has a much smaller economy at $235 million today, it was $199 during Katrina, it would be between Ireland and Greece if it was a state in Europe. So when you compare these two things and knowing what we saw from Katrina, and looking at the massive area this flood covered, I expect nothing but bad things to happen to the black people that live there. Four states in the U.S. have a population of 3 million or more. Three of them can be affected by these storms. Of course, Texas and Florida will be affected, and that's number four and number three. And number one is Georgia, and it looks like the storm at one path that it could go into inland Georgia, which would cause catastrophic effects. So we could have up to 9 million black people being displaced by these storms. There's another storm right behind this one and another one behind that one. So this is a lot of infrastructure that has value, which wasn't the fact in Louisiana, wasn't the fact in New Orleans. They have huge parts of the city that they didn't care about. But that's not going to be the case here. White people are very well invested in these cities and these states. These are their powerhouses. The United States can't function at full optimum ability without the economies of these states, unlike Louisiana's. So I expect the infrastructure, the property, the corporate interest to take value over the black lives that live in this city. I saw on the news they had black people going into the shelters like the firefighter spoke about. I didn't see any white people on that line. And the line was around the block, wrapped around about twice. And I said, wow. I watched a video from rapper Bun B. And he was crying, saying that the whites were refusing to pick up the people in the projects in Houston, down in one of the wards, saying that they should have evacuated, you know, like they had the opportunity to go somewhere. Also, whites have, see that whites have a Navy now. They have the Cajun Navy. We already saw in Charlottesville they had the white army and the white Navy, you know, the white army and the white Marines fighting each other in Charlottesville. So they have a Navy as well. I call them that was white power versus white privilege. That's what that whole fight was. The senator who was called for the assassination of a sitting president, that wasn't an intellectual decision on her behalf, especially, in my opinion, for a black elected official in the area of Ferguson. And we saw the Ferguson reports. And for a black elected official to even rerun after getting that report, which showed egregious racism that no one was checking, I just don't have a lot of empathy for her. But when I compare this to the guy, I mean, I remember when Obama gave his first State of the Union address and a white senator stood up and called him a liar and nothing was done to him. So I keep that in mind when I see that. And I'll mute my line for now. Thank you, guys.
Appreciate that. Maria Chappelle Nadal, the state senator in Missouri, who they are talking about kicking her out of her job for her social media post on President Trump. We have other folks who dialed in with a hand up that we've not heard from. Other folks who dialed in with a hand up.
May I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Peace to Gus. Peace to the listeners. Peace to those definitely that are in harm's way tonight. This is V from Central New York, right outside of Syracuse. And I want to begin by saying that Thomas in New York, his comments on infrastructure have been echoed, although they haven't necessarily spoken about the ramifications to Black people of climate change as much. But many engineers question if preference might go to the more privileged. Often they are speaking about the rich, not of racial groups, although it may be a little bit more in vogue now to begin to talk about that because so many others are talking about environmental racism. But earlier this week, I was listening to a podcast, and for the life of me, I can't think of his name now. I just had it. But from a science writer, said that he expected, as these storms became more frequent because of most likely global warming, but possibly for other reasons also, he said he expected there to be a dramatic empathy gap between what people originally wanted to give to fix things and what they are willing to give in the future. I think we're already seeing that anyway with the amount of tax revenues decreasing across the country. Many Black communities are basically disintegrating from an infrastructural point of view, and then whites go in, gentrify it, and then that's when they start building it up. In a city very close to me, Rochester, New York, they are about to elect another mayor. And it's possible the current mayor could stay in office, but one of the primary opponents of this mayor, I heard her giving an interview the other day, and her primary focus is of cleaning up this Black city's corruption and making it more business friendly by cutting taxes, making the streets safer, basically gentrification on steroids, though she does, that is a metaphor, excuse me, basically gentrification, but she doesn't call it that. And she doesn't talk about the increase in residential prices, which is already happening, and what will likely happen to the tax base as they cut the taxes to the city residents, should I say. But finally, I want to speak very quickly on the Missouri senator who posted that comment about assassinating Donald Trump. I will remind everybody, if you have a chance, go onto YouTube, watch Minister Farrakhan's hour-long dissection of all of the racist comments that were communicated, rather via speech, social media, interview. The list was amazing that he gave of people in government at multiple levels speaking about assassinating, throwing out of the country of the Obamas.
And these were very diabolical comments. Also, in Israel, in Israeli, I should have looked it up before I got on the phone, but I didn't actually remember it. But there is an Israeli person, I think it was from Chicago, who actually suggested in a Israeli newspaper of possibly assassinating President Obama if he didn't go along with Israel. So it is very hypocritical for these people to be making such a big deal out of that one comment when they have a long list of things that they said and continue to say about Barack Obama, his family, his wife. It is racism, I suppose. Thank you very much, Gus. I'm very glad that you're feeling better. You're sounding better. You're sounding refreshed. And I'm very glad you're back. Peace to you.
Much obliged. Other folks, if you dialed in, if you have a hand up, if we've not heard from you, speak now if you have commentary. Yes, ma'am. Little distortion in the line, but yes, we can hear you.
Let me try something. Driving. Is this better? Can you all hear me?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. I apologize about that. But greetings, everybody. This is Amy. And I, too, have heard about the sensory deprivation thing. And there's, like, one place around my way that does it. I had looked into it. I learned about it in psych class another form of, like, meditation or healing. And so I've heard that they're really cool. There's, like, two fields. Like, some people really hate it because they feel like it's just too much for them, that level of silence. And then other people absolutely love it. I think I'd love it. So. And I think that's awesome that you were able to have that experience. I think that's pretty neat. I don't have as much to say as I usually do, but regarding the comments that and everybody needing to apologize or, you know, ask for forgiveness and whatnot, I really don't think that that's constructive or helpful. And the entire time, every time I hear something like it, and when I was listening to the clip earlier, it reminds me of, and I don't think the attorney general that said this meant it this way, but, like, are we a nation of cowards, not being able to talk about racism? And I'm not calling her a coward, but in any way, I'm simply stating that that's what about race has become on a national level. Is a bunch of apologies and asking for forgiveness or giving forgiveness and nothing constructive at all. And whenever there's like a bunch of over-apologizing, it just makes me think of overly sensitive people, but that doesn't fix anything. Like, you have to keep saying you're sorry to somebody because you keep hurting their feelings every time you say something. They're just, you know, overly sensitive for no reason. And it makes for a very dysfunctional dynamic between individuals, but, you know, like in an interpersonal relationship, but definitely in mass, because that's pretty much what I hear the conversation about race is who says what when and what wrong thing they said, ask for forgiveness or apologize, and then that's just expanded or transposed onto other issues or bigger issues. So not necessarily what someone is saying, but what they're doing. You can ask for forgiveness and whatnot. So I don't think it's constructive. I hope that we can hear some more from the folks who are down in Florida and down in Texas to make sure they're okay, because I was thinking about them. I don't really know too many people in Texas. I do know a couple of folks in Florida, but they're well for right now as far as I know. But I am a little worried and concerned, and I do want them to be well. The one thing I remember, I had this thought, this would be the last thing, I had this thought for Grenfell Tower in England when it burned down, that one constructive thing that could help folks in a really bad situation like this is, and I know it's like there are dangers and risks in doing things like this, but scanning your important documents. So if there's a fire, you have them like in the cloud someplace. Of course, that won't be accepted by many people as like an official document, but it can at least go to show that you at one time had it. I know that there are, you know, there are a lot of people who've been naturalized or who have become citizens. So what happens when you still have your accent and you still have your name, but now you have no paperwork? Anyone could just make it very difficult. Even if, you know, my mom made the argument that, well, it's in some electronic database anyway. Yes, that's true. But if you're dealing with people who don't want to be helpful for you, to you or towards you, and you don't have that record to say that you have it, they could sit there and play dumb and stupid and make it very difficult for you to, you know, make moves. So, or to get your life back together. So that would be one suggestion I think that I would share with people, that scanning your information, having some type of electronic, like of your birth certificate, your social security, your passport, ID cards, titles for your car. I will say this, like I have renter's insurance and I have a picture of like all the things that I've purchased. I saw it kind of on Instagram, like they were saying take pictures of your rooms because when it comes to insurance, that will, you know, that will help. But I have actually taken pictures of all my stuff, like jewelry, instruments, like whatnot. I have pictures of those uploaded in the cloud. So if anything were to happen, I can use that. So I think having an electronic version of the things that are most important to you, so you have record that you at one time had it, can be constructive in a, you know, disaster of some sort. But with that, thank you all for listening.
Appreciate that, Emmy. Other folks that we have not heard from at all, if you have commentary, we would love to hear from you.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Good evening, everybody. 2812 from Virginia. Wrong metaphor. I'm going to agree with what Emmy just said. I'm in the mortgage business, and one of the things that I have friends that are in the Florida and also in the Houston area, but one of the main things that they were speaking of was many people that are there, specifically non-white people, not even having access to resources to even be able to leave. And even just having access to $1,000 that you're not worried about losing. So I know we've talked about this before economically, but, you know, some things are extremely important, and just being in finance, it's extremely important for you to just even have access to cash that is not tied to your normal everyday lifestyle, because unfortunately in this system, these kind of disasters happen pretty frequently, and it's just something that we should definitely be mindful of. And sometimes if you have to make sacrifices to do things that are less important, and it'll be able to help you save money, I just think that's very important. Along the lines of Houston, one of the main things I was thinking of was the mayor. I was in Houston about 2 years ago, and I believe his name is Mr. Turner. I could be wrong. And there was an article written about him maybe 3 weeks ago in the New York Times of how he was being applauded for not evacuating. And one of the earliest CALS programs that I listened to was the one when Gus was specifically speaking about what happened to that mayor in New Orleans with Katrina, and also the tackiness that happened with the mayor in Atlanta. And one of the things I just remembered is how quickly, you know, right now he's being applauded, but how quickly that can change, specifically for non-white people in the system. He could be a hero now, and in, you know, 2 years, if racists decide to, or in 2 months, you know, this guy will be at the bottom of the stump. Quick reminder of our non-white people in the Caribbean. One thing that I think people forget, or probably don't forget, but, you know, a huge portion of a lot of the non-white people that are in those particular areas is tourism. And the fact that many of the airports and the fact that many people cannot travel down there there's just going to be a lot of mass confusion and just mass dysfunction. And I would just say, don't be surprised if you start to see different incidents in those particular areas, similar to Haiti, similar to all the other non-white areas that are in that particular place. Quick workplace racism. I run a meeting, this meeting that I run, or not even run, but this meeting that I help coordinate, all white people. And the other morning, a white gentleman was sitting there while we were before we started, and he was talking to me about a sporting event at the University of Virginia. And he had mentioned the University of Virginia, you know, they suck, they're going to lose. And he said, oh, did you see what Howard University did? And I said, yes, I believe that they scored the biggest, and this is an area of entertainment, they scored the biggest upset in NCAA football history. Now, mind you, the University of Virginia's former coach, Mike London, is a black male with a black female wife, and he's the coach of that Howard team. So this white gentleman proceeds to say at the table, yeah, you know, I think Mike London was a really good fit for those kids. And I just said, well, what do you mean? Everybody's an athlete. And he said, you know. And I said, no, I don't know. I said, I'm just trying to understand. I don't know what you mean. He coached athletes at University of Virginia. He's coaching athletes at Howard. And then he said, well, we're not going to talk about this. And so that was him practicing racism, typically. And then I was on a college tour with my son in North Carolina, and we were attending an HBCU game. And I had an opportunity to talk to many alumni at North Carolina Central University, wonderful school. And even though that school lost the quote-unquote sporting event, many non-white people that were there were reminding a lot of young people that the university they were playing is Duke. So I just want to put it in perspective. Many non-white people there were reminding a lot of the young people there, even in just casual conversations that I was hearing, was that it was not always like this, and that, you know, before integration, the HBCUs were always the schools that were extremely dominant in the area of athletics. I learned about a gentleman named Mr. John McClendon, who actually, from what I was told and what my family was telling me, was that this guy actually was one of the pioneers to speed up the game of basketball and also helped invent the full court press. And I didn't even know this. I didn't even know about the secret game to where North Carolina Central used to destroy. They played one time, they destroyed Duke, but another older gentleman told me that they used to beat the crap out of Duke, and they played them. They played the all-white school many times. So that's all I had to share, a lot of constructive information. Good to hear from everybody on the line, and I'll mute my line. Thanks, Gus.
Yes, sir. We have about 30 minutes left in the broadcast, a little less than 30 minutes, actually. If you have commentary you would like to share, the number 641-715-3640, the code 564-943-#. Press *6 if you would like to participate. Is anybody on the line with us that we've not heard from at all? Anybody that we've missed completely?
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Thank you very much, sir. Greetings to Gus, the host, the listeners, and callers. I also had to get my wisdom teeth taken out. It was a little while ago, so definitely I share empathy with you. I'm glad you got through that process. But to speak on the hurricane ordeal, for the past couple of days, it's been kind of hectic up here, like a lot of traffic. And I really wanted to touch on the, I think they're using the term price gouging. Like when I went to go and get gas, I noticed the price had increased very much. Like when I went to the gas station, so there was a lot of people around. So I just went on ahead and put gas in the tank. But I wanted to also mention that because, like, I'm hearing, or I've heard before, that like on the other side of town, the prices would be a lot higher at gas stations. And I guess these are areas where they're populated by a lot of black people, but I've never really looked deep into it. So I think that could be an example of racism in this situation, because it's not really the gas prices that's really being price gouged, but like water and things like that. There's been reports of people charging like $25 to $30 for like a case of water at the, against like the Dollar General stores. So, you know, it's been an interesting observation as far as that is going, but it seems to be pretty much going through smoothly so far, but the interstate is very congested and people are trying to, I guess, evacuate the southern part of Florida to, I guess, go to places like hotels and whatnot. And I'm hearing those prices are being increased as well, you know, ironically, for this period of time. So, you know, I'm hearing that they want, I guess, people to call up and report it if they're noticing these price increases. But I'm thinking that, you know, now I don't really have no kind of research on it, but for some reason I'm thinking it's going to affect non-white people for the most part. But I wanted to also mention that the local police and the university police, they were, I'm hearing that they were really starting to, I guess, like beef up security or increase security for the Richard Spencer visit, but I think he has said he canceled it because of the hurricane, and he planned to reschedule a visit. So, you know, you have these, I think some of the Antifa people as well around here, and like the neo-Nazi people and all of that, I guess, planning to, you know, come by or whatever. So I guess they are going to put that on hold. And I wanted to mention another person that I've seen videos on. Like, I don't know if anyone's heard of this person. I think his name is Ben Shapiro or something. And, like, I mentioned his name because, like, there are videos of him, I guess, debating black people who ask him questions concerning race. And he tends to speak, like, very rapidly. I mean, it's amazing. Like, when you listen to it, he's speaking so fast, you gotta kind of rewind it, and it's like you can't really take in what he's saying to you. So he could just be just using a whole bunch of words that don't really even make sense. So I think that could be a tactic that the system is putting people out there to engage in, like a bunch of rapid speech. And that's all that I can think of right now. Oh, but actually, can I add one thing? Like, on the workplace racism, I had a really interesting update about the lady, the boss over in the civil department who was wearing the same attire. She broadcasted a letter talking about herself. And, you know, it was very interesting. Like, I had to print out the exact page from the newsletter from this month. So, you know, I was going to share that on the workplace racism. So she said she was talking about an experiment. So she revealed this to the people of the workplace. And that's all I have for now. Thank you.
Wow. That is a first for me to have anybody make some sort of announcement that they have been conducting an experiment in the workplace. Wow. Racist man and racist woman. If folks don't recall, I believe years ago when we had our last workplace racism program, caller, he was sharing that one of his suspected racist colleagues, this white woman, she had been wearing the same outfit. And it seemed there was enough evidence to suggest she had been doing this purposely and might have even been doing this to see if she could instigate people to begin spreading rumors about her. And, oh, you know, look at Becky over there, she's been wearing that same, you know, blouse for the past week. I can't believe it. To get that sort of thing started so that then she could go and report them and maybe even, you know, to get some black employees in trouble. We had talked about this before. So to see that now she has debriefing everyone that, yes, she's been conducting an experiment in the world. That is amazing. Amazing. We'll wait for additional details. We should be back this coming Thursday for workplace racism. Did we have other folks who had commentary? Did we get everybody? Anybody with a hand up that we've missed?
Beth, I have a quick question.
Yes, ma'am.
The first clip that you played about Jack Daniels, was that a recent clip? Because I really feel like you have played that clip before, or was there something new about it that I just didn't catch?
They have been talking about that. I've played segments about that before, but this was new just because this black female in the clip, her moving to Lynchburg, Tennessee, to get additional information. That was the first that I heard of that, but I had been hearing other reports, and I think I'd even played at least one other on the program where they have been talking about Mr. Green and him, his contribution to getting the Jack Daniels made and all of that, because it's been getting more attention. At least I've been seeing more about it over the last year or so.
Okay, I see. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Can I be
hurt? Yes, sir.
Yeah, Gus, I make sure that I bring some Jack Daniels when we meet up at the hot springs for the next trip.
That's right.
Man, I wanted to say one more thing about the hurricanes. The Caribbean has been hit dramatically. And these are our people. These are black people. When they come here, they're black. They get treated just like us. They share our blood type. These are our people. They have been, I saw St. Martin. It wasn't a building standing. St. Kitts, St. Regis, St. I mean, it was so heartfelt. And one of my friends in Harlem, he was sending out things, trying to reach his mother, I believe in St. Thomas. So just traumatic. The footage that we're still not covering that much, of course, because the storms are here as well. But I haven't seen that type of devastation. And that was Category 5 that they went through. Total devastated. So I definitely keep those people in our prayers as well. And those are going to be hotbeds for human trafficking. White people will take advantage to go in there acting like they're going to save people. They have a harder time doing this. They will do it in Florida and Texas. In Louisiana as well, because they're flooded, but they'll be doing it with no impunity in the islands where they have no methods of communication or anyone they could go tell. So I expect a Haiti-type situation. Price gouging. The price of gas has gone up here in New York as well. It's going to go up everywhere because Texas is a huge refinery state. And prices on everything else are going to go up because most of our things move by gas or cars or trucks. So be expecting to feel the effects of the economy, which is why I was mentioning the economic value of those states, because that's going to affect us all. In the store, a loaf of bread is going to go up, a bottle of water, things that we buy all the time are going to be much more costly. And I take it that the young scholar didn't call in this week, so please remind me next time he calls in, because I have a question, and it was dealing with just showing, it was an experiment, just showing how racists do things and don't tell us. So I was going to ask yourself, the young scholar, and an older gentleman, a firefighter, the same question, and I was going to see if you got the same answer, and it's something general knowledge. So I'll mute my line. Thank you.
Can you hear?
Yes, sir.
Awesome. This is Ken Steele, and I just wanted to report, this kind of goes along with the report regarding football. The opening or the ratings for the 2017 NFL season opener between the, I believe, the Kansas City Chiefs and the New England Patriots are in. And the reports are indicating that the ratings have suffered a double-digit dip. Some articles are saying that it is 12%. Other articles I've read have indicated that it's 13%, and some others have indicated that it's a 14% ratings drop. The suspected racists are trying to attribute this ratings drop to a number of different causes. Some people are saying it's the weather. Other people are saying it's Trump. Other suspected racists are saying that that people are tired of watching TV and people are unwilling to watch football games anymore because they're bored of football. And they are all trying to downplay the impact of the planned protests of football games that are being done by victims of racism protesting the actions of the suspect racists that are in charge of the NFL. And yeah, 14, 13, 12%, any double-digit dip in ratings, I don't believe that's a fluke. Some suspected racists are saying that viewers should wait until the Dallas Cowboys game to determine if these ratings drops are in fact not a fluke. But you know, I think that that is just denial on the part of racists. That I think that this is an example of victims of racism being on code and not participating in events and giving money to organizations that are mistreating us. So I just want to say that that is, in my opinion, really good news. I think that's constructive information. I think that it's great that many victims are not participating in the pageantry associated with the NFL. And also, more and more players are beginning to protest into the regular seasons. So I think this is an interesting series of developments, and I think that this is constructive, and it shows that that victims are making attempts at rectifying this situation. I'll go ahead and mute my line at this time. Thank you so much.
There was an article. Yes, sir. I was just
going to say
really quick, there was an article in the Chicago Tribune this week by a white columnist, suspected racist, who's written a number of reports, even about Hurricane Katrina, you know, in my view, revealing that he is not trying too hard to hide his devotion to white supremacy. But that said, he wrote this piece this past week about football and saying that it's over. Everything about this is over, and saying specifically he thinks it's over because you have a sizable population of white people who are not interested in watching football anymore. They're still upset about that no good Negro, Colin Kaepernick, Cowbell, and the rest of them, who have been talking about the anthem or not standing for the anthem and talking about racism and all that, and the concussions and blah, 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 and all this stuff. But just saying, hey, you have a sizable population of white people who they are done with football. And if that is true, that football is going to be out of here in a matter of years. But he just wrote that past couple days this week. Roz, that was you. Proceed, sir.
Yes. If that is the case, then you're right, because they're the ones who are the propagators of the sport. And like Dr. Wilson has always said, all sports in the system of white supremacy are related to some form of genetic annihilation, whether it's by black genetic material or white genetic material annihilating non-white genetic material. So you're right. If they're no longer interested in that sport, it will disappear quite rapidly. I also wanted to also just talk about the Caribbean as well. I'm actually just lucky because the island that my family's from is the most southern Caribbean island. So we've missed quite a few significant hurricanes. The last one that I remember hearing about was one when my grandmother was alive. And that was like back, this is for her, I think back in like the late 60s, early 70s that it hit Trinidad and Tobago. But I know Barbuda was definitely leveled. Antigua was also hit. There's a bunch of them. And also because Miami's an area where a lot of other Caribbean people migrate to, you might get a situation where people have family in the Caribbean that have been struck. And if they're also in, if they live here and are in line for what's happening in Florida, then you might have two sets of families from the same area that are both equally hit, one in the Caribbean, one here. So these are all things we have to take into consideration, excuse me, as well. I know that like New York City is the most populated Caribbean with, as far as Caribbeans outside of the Caribbean. Brooklyn is, and the Bronx are the two main places, but New York City is the place that has the highest concentration of Caribbean people outside of the Caribbean itself. But Miami is another heavily populated place with people from some of those islands. So definitely keep them in your prayers because, like Thomas said, tourism is their major economic engine functions on tourism for a lot of these people. So they're not going to be able to really recover. I know Puerto Rico, they said half the island was out of electricity. And due to the fact that they're bankrupt, they're going to, as a commonwealth, that they won't be able to recover for 6 months. So these people will be 6 months without electricity, and it could possibly be longer. Of course, them being non-white people, they'll probably be neglected even more, especially now that they're bankrupt, because any money that they generate will go towards recovery and paying off the debt that they owe. So it's just going to be really bad to watch this unfold as far as the different countries that were affected, Puerto Rico itself, and the different places in the mainland that were also affected as well. I wanted to also touch on Emmy when she spoke about the profuse apologizing by the senator. And it just reminds me, I've always postulated that racism, white supremacy is an acute terror of genetic annihilation, and awareness of that coupled with three functional mental illnesses, that's psychopathy, sociopathy, and narcissism, acute narcissism. And what she was describing was delectable Negro behavior in the form of acute narcissism, because that sort of profuse apologizing is the thing that they expect from Black people. That's the kind of stuff they used to abuse us into performing. So just seeing her go through those motions was no different than any other slave on the plantation having to do the same thing. And it gives white people just a greater satisfaction if they're not physically terrorizing us to see us groveling, or in their minds groveling. So I just wanted to put that out there. That was a definite delectable Negro kind of a situation, pure consumption and the enjoyment of the consumption of Black suffering in that form in a public situation. Also, when she discussed scanning documents, I agree emphatically. Some of the other things you can do as far as saving information is saving it to an external hard drive. I usually take all of my important papers, I save them on an external hard drive in case my computer crashes. I still have access to all of those files and can just upload them on the computer once it's either repaired or changed. Also, you can get USB discs that hold substantial amounts of information. They have them, 14 gigs, all over the place, just different sizes. But ultimately, you can also, because what I do is save them on multiple USB disks that hold a lot of files, and my external hard drive. So that way, if any of one of those mediums get destroyed, I can always go back to the other USB disk as well as a means of retrieving that information if anything becomes corrupted. So I just wanted to put that out there as well in regards to ways that you can, save your important documents, whether you're scanning them, like she said, and then just saving them to those different mediums. That might be another protective mechanism for you in case something like this happens where you lose access to your files, or a catastrophic event causes that situation and where you lose your important information. And I also wanted to talk about Thomas when he talked about Bun B. Bun B also said that literally all of his group's archives have been completely destroyed in Houston by the storm. So basically all of their music, his partner died a number of years ago. They were going to release unreleased material. That's all gone. So I just wanted to put that out there. Thank you, and I'll mute my line.
Context of white supremacy, definitely.
Can I say one more thing? Sorry.
Yes, sir.
I just wanted to say, you know, about the NFL. I've been watching for years. They've been jacking up their numbers. Other than the Super Bowl, which is huge, you know, it's a family event. It's the cheap, you know, one of the cheapest days, the cheapest day to go to the supermarket, you know. They jacked their numbers up. They've been trying to promote it to women, even having women jerseys now. What the problem is they're trying to be too conservative. They're being killed by the NBA. The NBA ratings is way higher than theirs. They're still trying to promote football with country music. NBA's using hip hop. I mean, they're not marketing the product to the right demographic. People want to see what we want to see. They don't, you know, they're living vicariously through us. So, what I think that they just trying to keep it conservative, trying to keep it white. They know that, and I expect to see in the next couple of years a real hip hopping and up of football. They're gonna, you know, exploit the fact that hey, we got all these black people here, you know, playing on these teams. Let's, you know, some football reality shows and things just to try to spruce it up because their model is failing. And the white athlete, you know, I mean, a new black girl just won in tennis other than the Williams sisters. You know, we saw what happened to McGregor. Total domination. So it's over, you know. So they have to tighten up. Baseball was smart to jump onto the Latino thing. And that's worked great for them. Football is way behind, and they really need to get into the new century of marketing and things. I'll meet my line. Thank you.
Hey, Gus.
I would not complain to see it go out of business. That would be grand, in my opinion. Yes, sir.
Hey, did that article with Amy Goodman when Invisible Houston? Did she say that was the 30th anniversary of that book or the third?
I'm pretty sure she said 30th because that book was published in approximately 1987, so it's about the 30th year anniversary, not third.
Wow. Oh, okay. That's interesting. Thanks.
What's interesting about that?
Oh, well, it's not really. It's not super interesting, but the fact that they've been practicing racism for that long, and just by the way she asked a question to him, like, you know, this is the 30th anniversary of your book, you know, talk about it as if something with like something, as if something had changed in those 30 years. And literally, I read the I just Googled the transcript since you mentioned that, and I found it, and nothing has changed. In 30 years, you know, Houston still has the same, quote-unquote, invisible black people problem that they've had 30 years ago. That's what I mean, you know.
I see. Yeah. Seems to be worse, if anything. One thing that did stand out of that interview, it was a lot of great information. My BFF, Amy Goodman, haven't played one of her segments on the program in a minute. She asked the question about the pollution sites that in the Houston area, that I think 100% of them were in areas where black people live. She didn't say 90%. She didn't say 95%. She didn't say 80%. She didn't even say like 99.1. She said 100% of these toxic sites are in areas where black people live. And when the doctor responded, he said, blacks and Latinos. That right there, I hear that pattern consistently. I never say blacks and Latinos. It's VGQ. People can say whatever they want. But I mean, why she didn't say 100% of these sites are in areas where blacks and Latinos live, or black and brown people, or any other iteration. She said 100% are in black areas. And even then, you cannot just respond and say, yes, they have been terrorizing black people. Yes, racism, white supremacy impacts a lot of folks, but wow, they have been specifically, and it seems in Houston, exclusively targeting black people for specific means of economic terrorism. We can't even get a clean response, accurate response. No matter, we can't even get an accurate response so that when BFF has already said it's 100% of these locations are in black areas.
Yeah.
Can I be heard real quick?
Yes, sir.
Yes, going along with the whole...
Oh, and you have 30 seconds because we are about out of here. Get it in 30 seconds?
Yeah. You know what? I'll save this for next week. Thank you so much.
Ken Steele saving it for next week? Where we should be, because I have no dental appointments, and we should be ready for all of our normal broadcast times. But before we even get to the normal schedule, Dr. Martin Kevorkian will be with us on 9/11 this Monday. The four films, The Place Beyond the Pines, came out in 2013, Ray Liotta, Eva Longoria, the black male actor he was in, Luke Cage. He's in House of Cards, Marshall Ali. I think I'm probably mispronouncing his name, but he's in The Place Beyond the Pines. The Big Lebowski, 1998. I'm sure folks have seen it. Might need to see it in a different context to grasp why this film was selected. 2016 film, Little Boxes, Nelson Ellis, the late Nelson Ellis, black male actor, passed away just a couple weeks ago this summer. And I don't feel at home in this world anymore. There are actually two different racist jokes right at the beginning, and I mean the very beginning, like first 180 seconds of I don't feel at home in this world anymore. You got to watch real close to catch it, because it's someone watching television in the movie, so you have to pay attention to what they're watching and then connect that with what they begin saying. But this is like the first 3 minutes of the film, bam, racist joke right out of the gates. And I don't feel at home in this world anymore. And that film came out this year. But those are the four we'll be discussing with Dr. Martin Kevorkian, admitted white supremacist and Texas resident, this coming Monday, 9/11. Good hearing from everyone. Florida residents, again, be safe. Kamisha M. Africa, we didn't hear from her, but she does Understanding Isness right here at Black Talk Radio Network, investor at the Cows for years, and lots of other folks. Princess, I hope you all are safe, hopefully, out of town. Hopefully the storm will miss you all completely, and, you know, this will just be, you know, we did not, you know, have to deal with all of that and close call and move forward. But we will definitely be thinking and praying for you all over the next few days, and you, your family, hoping everything is well and you all are safe. If you have questions, if you can't find something, if you're looking for something in the archives, if you're just confused about the programs that were missed, feel free to drop an email. Since I've been going back for repeated wisdom teeth extractions, I am a little behind on my email, but should be catching up on that since we don't anticipate having any further complications with all that. We'll be catching up, so you can feel free to drop an email again if there's a delay in response. It's been a difficult month with health issues, but it seems things are clearing. With that, I hope it was a constructive investment of your Saturday evening. I will certainly say again, I don't know if this counts as a what they call holiday weekend. I think 9/11 is recognized as a holiday in some parts, but sobriety would still be best. I know the summer is winding down, so folks might be out doing their last final go out and have a good time while it's still mildly warm. Fine, but just keep in mind, race soldiers, they have terrorized a lot of black people. And it's been my observation that Jack Daniels, man, that has only made things worse in many, many situations where we have not been able to make great decisions. We have not been able to accurately recognize, oh, wow, this is a system of racism, white supremacy, and I need my brain computer functioning at maximum efficiency. All of these drugs and poisons, Jack Daniels, is not going to help me do that. Just keep that in mind. If you can't be sober, at least get to one spot and stay there, one spot with no whites. And certainly, if you're going to be behind the wheel, buckle up. If you're going to be in a vehicle, period, passenger, driver, whatever it is, you want to be buckled up and sober. That said, Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Kyle signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim,
your
brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning.
Mm-hmm.
Even my conditioning has been conditioned.